Why does your
book completely fall apart when I point out this little detail? God damn you.
I just was hoping it wasn't a strange question.
Maybe.
Is someone getting some strange? What's happening?
Oh, dearie.
No. We won't judge you, Cargill.
Do not judge.
On this podcast.
No judgment.
We love you.
No, you don't.
Hugs all around. No.
Let's record.
Oh, we are recording.
Oh, we're recording already?
Welcome to the original gentleman. Yeah, mine's like, gotta stop trying to make us do a thing set up ahead of time. Great, I'll just start pressing with the cord without letting you know.
Good, that's what you should do. Yeah. Because I ad-lib so much better when I know I'm not doing it.
To be fair, it works for Chris Hardwick pretty well on The Nerdist. All the time, there are these big celebrities, and they're going on about drinking or something. He's like, when are we going to start? He's like, oh, dude, we started a minute and a half ago. What? Anyway.
Of course, he knows much more interesting people than we do.
True.
Oh, fuck you. Fuck you, Bo.
And now our special guest from the Peanut Gallery.
Fuck you.
You know you'll be on The Nerdist eventually, Cargo. You know
Doubtful.
You will.
Come Doubtful.
It's only a matter of time.
Oh, come on. The writer of Doctor Strange? How could you not? What?
Oh, wait, he's writing it? I thought he was cast in it.
Well, no, I mean, come on. His boy is directing it. Just give us the exclusive.
Then why is he wearing the blue kimono and the red cloak?
You've been tapped to write it. Let's just get that out off on the table.
I can tell you with all honesty, with 100% honesty, no decisions about the writing of Doctor Strange have been made. I can tell you that my boy, Scott Derrickson, that my writing partner, is in fact directing Doctor Strange.
Uh-huh.
And that
and his only good movies are when you write them.
And, that's right. Whoa.
Come on.
Were you the one that was on my side about Exorcism Emily Rose? I recall that it was me and you that liked it.
Yeah, we both liked that movie.
I never saw it.
Yeah, you did. You came out to dinner with us afterwards.
Yeah.
It was me, you, Corey, Chris, and Jessica all eating at what is that, Baby Acapulco's?
Oh, I'm sorry. I got it mixed up with something else. Yeah.
Yeah, no, he made that one, and when that was without me. So, yes, he's made good movies without me.
I like that one, too, for the record.
Okay. Well, all right.
Yeah, what other movies has he made anyway?
Oh, he did the first direct to video. His very first directing gig was the direct to video Hellraiser movie.
I'm gonna just assume that probably wasn't good, just from what I've heard.
Well, it depends. For those
did Cargo write it?
No.
For those who are hardcore Hellraiser fans, it's considered the only good Hellraiser direct to video movie.
Okay, so it's not the one in space, right?
No. It's the one immediately after the one in space. But the problem is, it's also the one that Clive Barker hates. Like, Clive Barker's fine with it in space. Clive Barker hates it when somebody goes, "Hey, I've got a different idea for how to tell a Hellraiser movie," and Clive Barker's like, "Oh no." So then he went and he had Exorcism Emily Rose, which is a huge hit.
Yeah.
And then he did a little movie for Fox called Day the Earth Stood Still, which did very well, but was critically lambasted.
Did you write that one?
I did not write that one.
That's why.
And important to note, neither did Scott. Scott didn't write that. And then Scott was in director jail for a while. And we had already become friends.
I believe that's just the director penalty box.
It's funny. When Scott and I, when we,
the Day the Earth Stood Still is definitely an example of high sticking. Somebody got their teeth knocked.
I actually like a lot about Day the Earth Stood Still. I enjoyed it. And
I actually did not think it was terrible, but it did not need to be made.
Well, it's, you know what? I disagree. I love the original Day the Earth Stood Still.
I do too.
And the Earth is saved because an alien takes an 8-year-old boy to a fucking baseball game. That's the end of the fucking movie.
I thought it was because Bruce Campbell read the words in the Necronomicon.
No, that is incorrect, sir.
Okay.
What the world is saved because an alien goes to a baseball game with an 8-year-old boy and goes, "Oh, hey, this civilization is worth saving. I love the Yankees." And that's how the Earth gets saved. And I
Although
thought it was
that is incredibly implausible, because more likely they go, why? My God, you're the most boring species.
I was down with that story being retold. I had no qualms about that. I mean, it's a great movie, but it's a movie that is clearly dated. It's a movie we don't continue to watch in this day and hand people copies of Day the Earth Stood Still and go, oh my God, you have to watch this movie. It's going to blow your mind. And so I enjoyed his rendition of it. They did some really badass things with it. They did some cool stuff, but it was a movie that was not totally in his control. It was Fox and he didn't write it. And it was not the draft of the script that he had agreed to direct.
Sure.
And so,
points to them on the Blu-ray release of including the Blu-ray of the original Day the Earth Stood Still, including a huge passel of extra features and everything. So it was like, okay, admittedly, that's kind of about as cool a bonus thing as you could throw into a film.
But the one,
they should always do that.
Indeed, they should.
But the one thing that can really be said about Scott's career is the movie that people consider the worst movie in his catalog is the one he didn't write. And then, of course, what happened was, you know, he and I ended up working together on Sinister.
Oh, you wrote that film?
I wrote that piece of shit.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
No, I thought you said he wrote Insidious.
No, it was funny. No, but here's why I'm telling this story. The reason I'm telling this is because, you know, we were going to get ready for a meeting for Sinister, and he goes and he puts on a suit jacket. And I'm like, oh, shit. I didn't bring a suit jacket. Am I supposed to?
He's like, no, own a suit
no.
jacket?
He's like, no, you're a writer. You're fine. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, I'm like, do you need to wear a suit jacket? He goes, when you direct The Day the Earth Stood Still, you got to wear the jacket. and it was one of my favorite things he ever said to me.
Clopped a necktie.
That was good. I like that one.
But now he doesn't have to wear the jacket anymore because, you know, things are going very well for him. And now he's the director on Doctor Strange. And I've seen his presentation for Strange. And, dude, you guys are going to lose your fucking mind for this movie. The movie he wants to make is going to be fucking badass. That's what I can say. I'm not allowed to say anything else. But so don't ask. Don't give me that look, Martin. Don't give me that, you know, you could have asked possible questions before the mics were on. But now the mics are on. All bets are off. Right, I am
so
not saying
that. He got talking and told me the other day. So here's what happens. Patton Oswalt is going to be Dr. Strange. All right.
Yeah. And Patton Oswalt walks up and goes, excuse me, do you have your lanyard? lanyards will be given out on a case by case basis.
Well, he's like Surgeon Dr. Strange, but then he gets the power of what's my mama, and then he turns into George
by the great Herber of Herber.
Oh my God. So, you people can't even quote the hoary hoax of Hogoff. Man, this is in the wrong hands already.
So, what I'm hearing is while you're not the writer, you are the partner of the director, and you know a lot about comic books, and yet somehow he may go to someone else to help him.
Well, it's not him. It's not him.
It's Marvel. It's Marvel's decision. Yeah. Everything you've heard about Marvel being in complete control of what they're doing, they really are. And they really.
So there's no chance you might get tapped to write a pass.
No, what I'm saying is no decisions have been made as to what's going to happen.
Yeah,
what I'm saying.
Didn't they say, we're looking, like he suggested you, and they said, well, we're looking elsewhere.
No, there's a lot that is going on behind the scenes that I am not allowed at liberty to talk about for a number of reasons.
Well, that's all you had to say.
Well, that's what I said. I said
no decisions about
the writing team.
No. You were saying I have no news to report is what you were saying.
It's possible.
But when you say I'm not allowed to say things,
there's a lot of stuff.
That means there's things to say.
What?
You just aren't going to say them.
Sure.
I know it's Doctor Strange, but
there's a difference. Does no one see the difference?
Anyway, welcome to the original gentleman.
The original gentleman. Hi.
I know it's Doctor Strange, but can you?
God, you guys couldn't get 2 minutes into this episode before grilling me.
Can you put Rocket Racer in it?
Now, is it Dormammu or Dormammu?
It's Dormammu.
Damn. Okay.
I like Dormammu.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like your mama somehow. I probably maybe change it, put an accent grav in there somewhere. Right.
Well, why does this? You know, that's the thing. It's Hollywood. It's like, why does he have to be flaming, and why does he have to wear the purple? And can he just be better?
The guy wearing purple is flaming.
Oh,
it's like Alan Cummings as Dormammu. Oh, honey, you're going straight to hell.
Oh, Alan Cumming is never doing another Marvel movie again. Yeah, Are you kidding? Yeah.
Well, nothing he has to wear makeup.
Did he burn bridges?
No. They loved him, and he loved being an X-Men, too. I ended up doing an interview with him back in, I think, 2006, I want to say, back for the early days of film.com. And I asked him about it, and he's like, wow, you're the first person to ask me about why I'm not coming back. And I was like, well, can you tell me? He's like, yes, I would love to. He's like, I loved everyone I worked with. I just couldn't sit in the chair, the makeup chair, for 8 hours a day.
And it's like, oh my God,
you were so great. And he's like, well, thank you so much. I'm so glad, and it did so much for my career, but I can't do that again. And so he didn't want to do the makeup chair again for that long.
Ian McKellen is like, what a pussy. Did you know he was 25?
I'll tell you, he's really telling him to go fuck himself is Jennifer fucking Lawrence. She's like, oh, really, Alan? Why don't you try doing it naked?
Yeah, you didn't like being painted blue? Try it with scales.
Well, it's funny how...
Yeah, doesn't that sound like the worst job in the world, being the makeup artist that has to paint Jennifer Lawrence's naked body? Yeah. I mean, doesn't that just sound like 8 hours of torture?
It sounds frustrating. Yeah. As a matter of fact.
I'd love to have been had a hidden camera for the discussion where she was trying to say, is there no way to do this with CG? Is there no way?
Shut your mouth.
But as Bo said, welcome to the original gentleman. We, of course, Ashley could not be here this week. She had better things to do. What are you going to do?
That couldn't have been that.
She's got a vagina. She always has better things.
That's true. I've got to give her like a month and a half advance notice for a show because she's like, I got things. Yeah. but yes, we love Ashley. We're just kidding. But yeah, she will be back next week, presumably. In the meantime, we have another long hair replacing her. See Robert Cargill.
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. It's a couch full of bald guys. Like, you guys don't, you guys have less hair than a porn star's fucking snatch over there. I mean, it's really shiny and beautiful, and I kind of want to ask you how you avoid the chafing.
Well, now, to be fair, we still, when we're together, are often referred to as the trail to heaven, so.
Thought it was the Trail of Tears.
Depends on the trail.
Happy trail.
More like the Oregon Trail, because people tend to die of dysentery.
Not around us.
Okay. Just due to.
Oh, fair enough. All right, well, you know what? Let's get into stuff we like. And this week, we're really basing this episode around stuff Cargill brought us. And we're going to start off with one of the shows that I know that he's really into right now that we love as well, which is The Americans, which is now just finished up. It's season 2. I'm only 9 episodes into season 2, but I gotta say, I mean, Martin, you were telling me you weren't enjoying the second season as much as the first one, but I actually, right off the bat, started liking it a lot more than the first one.
Oh, is that
one.
Right?
I felt like a lot of the stuff they were doing with the characters was adding just significant extra levels of emotional depth to the things they had to go through, especially with the Russian chick who's hooked up with Noah Emmerich, who was like her handler,
Nadia.
But then she's spying on him, and now it's gone like there's like triple spying. I mean, after a point, she's just gonna go, I don't even know who I'm spying for anymore.
Well, I mean, this girl, she's been in a vice since, you know, the first time she appeared,
which I think was the first episode.
Yeah, and it's just like she's just gone from being in one to the next, where it's just like, oh great, this guy has something on me. They got something on me. Oh, here's this new guy. Now he's got something on me. One of these guys is going to ultimately fuck me, and I don't know how I'm going to maneuver my way around this.
I was going to say, hasn't all these guys actually fucked
her? Well, yeah.
No, that's not true.
No, physically.
Only two of them.
Only physically fucked her, yes. No. Which are scenes I do not mind watching.
Yeah, she's like a Russian Scarlett Johansson.
She is very hot, and she's a very good actress. The one problem I will say is that her accent slips a lot.
Does it?
Yeah.
I never noticed her accent.
And the thing is, her mother...
She really is Russian.
She didn't even know that
she's not... She didn't live in Russia, though, apparently. Her mother was Russian.
She's fake Russian.
Yeah, well...
Martin's barely aware that she has speaking lines. She's speaking lines. What? Huh?
Wait, what? I just remember a bare naked ass, and occasionally she takes the bra off, and from behind we see a little side boob.
Can you boob the words coming out of my boobs?
Oh, it's the original misogynistic gentleman.
Yes.
But I really, you know, the one thing I'm glad they got rid of is like there was this you know, crisis, emotional crisis going on between Kerry Russell as the Russian agent, KGB agent, yeah. agent, you know, one of the primary people posing as a good right. Americans, and her husband, Matthew Rhys, as Philip. There was like a lot of the emotional strife between them felt very manufactured in the first season.
Really? See, that, not to me at all. As a matter of fact, that's what I love so much. I was like, I like the, I was in love with the premise, but the tension going on between them to where it's like, yes, for years we've been pretending to be an American married couple who has kids, but he genuinely had feelings for her.
I understand.
For her, it was just like, this is just a job.
I understand the reasoning, but they dragged it out for like 6 or 7 episodes, and it was like, okay, this is getting a little soapy for me.
No, no, I only didn't like it like when they resolved it, and then suddenly there was a problem again.
Right. But in the second season, it's kind of like, you know what, forget all that.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we are agents and we're going to do our job. And aspects of that keep coming back into the story to the deal that, like, I mean, just in the 9th episode, I think it was that I just watched, there's a thing where he had bought, like, this, you know, Camaro, brand new Camaro, mm-hmm. and was basically like, look, just admit that there are some advantages to being here.
And let me be the first to tell you that buying a Chevy is not one of them. Fuck you.
Well, there is that thing where it's like, yes. Americans suck, but America is awesome.
No, you know, I both agree and disagree with both of you. I love both seasons equally.
Okay.
I love the drama of the first episode. I love the first season. I love the fact that, you know, because what I think is so great about that first season is he's clearly in love with her.
Yeah.
She, for him, this is just her job, her duty to her country. And then there comes a moment where he does something that is completely unexpected to her. And all of a sudden she's like, I didn't realize this is who this guy is. He really loves me. Oh my God, this is the guy I belong with. And then she starts having problems with the elements of their job that involve them, you know, fucking other people.
Right.
And all of a sudden it's like, wait, I care for this guy. And this guy isn't maybe who I think he is. I don't know. And so you have that drama. And then what I love about the second season, and the second season really ups the element of paranoia, because one of the problems yeah. that you really see after watching the second episode, the second season, is that the first season really is kind of this episodic, hey, let's watch these great, you know, spies do their spy thing. And in the second season, it's like, oh no, these people could die at any minute. They right. need to be scared every moment of the day. And you finally feel that. And when it comes crashing down on them, it's like, holy shit, something terrible is going to happen to their family at any moment.
Yeah, and the whole intro of like another whole group of another family like theirs, where the kids don't know, you know, they're a little bit older, and that the parents are spies, and they walk in on them in a hotel room, massacred, brutally massacred. And the part of the impetus of the season is, who the fuck did that?
Yeah.
Like, that's the big mystery.
And you aren't even there to figure that out.
No, I haven't even gotten to the end yet.
Because I guess, like, for what I was saying about the second season, whereas I find I still liked it a lot, maybe even loved it, just wasn't as emotional for me as the first season. The ending, whoa.
Yeah. The end of the second season is, holy God.
I can hardly wait.
And the thing is it clearly, it sets up what the third season's going to be. And it's like, holy shit,
please tell me that there is going to be an arc where they are sent to infiltrate the night court set to take out rising young star Yakov Smirnoff.
No.
Because that's the whole reason I'm watching this thing, you know, is just to see him get capped.
One of the things I love about the nostalgia and the references is that it's all where I grew up.
Yeah.
So there are very specific references that nobody outside of that area knows. Like
oh, they're going to Tom Carvel's.
When you take Junkie self-defense, then you too will say, nobody bothers me. I was like, nobody knows that commercial. I didn't live in D.C., and they watch it on the show. I'm like, holy shit. They played that every commercial break of every show.
It is fun to watch something that's a period piece, unlike Mad Men, where I go like, oh, I bet it was like that. Where I can watch and go like, no, this is actually accurate.
You know, there's a great, and this won't be a big spoiler, but there's that great plot line where their son breaks into the neighbor's house to play Intellivision.
Yes.
Because he's been dying for an Intellivision and been begging for one for episode after episode, and they won't buy him a fucking Intellivision because, you know, because they're communists who don't want their kids buying into this whole capitalist bullshit.
Even though when you actually see the hardware, I believe it was an Odyssey.
Shh.
Just saying.
No, you're not wrong. having actually watched the episode, I was like, I'm gonna suspend disbelief for a second. We're supposed to believe it's in a television. They didn't actually say that was in a television. He could have been playing an Odyssey, yeah. And that's what the neighbors had, and it's like, fuck it. Because it wasn't like he was playing Dungeons and Dragons on the Intellivision.
It had fucking Pitfall on it. That's all that matters.
Yeah. No, it didn't.
But the references on that show and the thing is, what's funny is, you know, one of the things growing up, one of the things that really interested me was, the history of spying and counterintelligence. Mm-hmm. I was fascinated with it, so I watched a bunch of shows on it, read a bunch of books, and every 5 minutes or so, I'll pause the show and lean over to my wife, and it's like, okay, so what Reagan's talking about here with Poland, so here's what happened with that, and here's what that's about. And at one point, she's like, how does it feel to have spent a substantial part of your middle school and high school life and finally seen it pay off?
And it's like, the answer is,
I imagine it does.
The answer is awesome. It feels it's so like, fucking
finally,
awesome.
All of that knowledge in the back of my head is finally useful. It's making the show better.
It's like Ready Player One.
Goddamn right, Ready Player One by Ernie Cline, available wherever you buy books.
I think it was in first season where the Russians were getting up in arms about the Star Wars defense program they'd heard about, and you're just sitting there watching like,
you poor bastard, you're going to waste so much money on this.
But that's what's so cool about this is they, you know, as much as the Russians are the very successful spies in this show, the things they go after and the things they do, you realize it's like, holy fuck. It's like, this is, in fact, you know, it's like they thought they knew what they were doing. And yeah. At the same time, they totally were completely blind. It was like, there's that moment in the second season where, you know, they deal with the submarine sinking. Uh-huh. And I lean over to my wife and I'm like, that's what Hunt for October was based on. And she's just like, oh. And I'm like, yeah, this is where Tom Clancy got that was uh-huh. from this actual fucking event that they're recreating here in the show. Like, they're like, the thing that I love about this show is that it does such a great job of weaving together the real history of what happened with a fictional setup about some very real things that were happening at that time that all play into important historical events and important pop culture that we've drawn from since.
Yeah,
and like, there's just such a, it's this beautiful nexus point for nerds. That, like, it's a show that the average person can watch and be into, but the deeper nerd you are and the deeper you are into history and spy culture and the pop culture that grew out of that, the better this show gets. And I'm madly in love with the show because that's, you know, I'm kind of fucking nerdish that way.
And one of the big things about this show is that it brought us Matthew Reese, who I think is amazing. And I'm like, holy God, is that
good guy good? Yeah. Well, not only that, it brought us back Felicity.
Oh, Carrie Russell.
Carrie Russell. I mean, and I've always liked Carrie Russell. In fact, no, let me stop. I've always loved Carrie Russell. I've always thought she's really great. I thought she never got the shake she deserved. If you remember, we all reviewed years ago August Rush, which I quite enjoyed seeing.
I don't even remember that. No, I'm trying to remember it too.
I remember August, was it Waitress that she was in Waitress.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, August Rush was this really sweet film about this boy who grew up without his two parents. He was an orphan and he'd been given up at birth and he wanted to bring his parents together. He's a musical prodigy and Carrie Russell was the mother and that was her big comeback movie. And she was really fantastic in it as the mom of this boy. You guys are going to watch the trailer later and go, oh fuck, I've seen this movie. Okay. And, oh, yeah, I hated it, and Cargill loved it for some reason, because Cargill's a fucking sissy, Bridget.
We say that about a lot of movies.
Yeah, this is also true.
It's funny, when you actually create stuff, you're so good at it that we're like, how is it that you thought that so many of those crappy movies were good?
Wait a minute, okay. Is that why my screenplays keep falling through, is I don't like enough crappy movies?
keep in mind that one of the things you've given me a hard time for is that, you know, these crappy movies that I love, I see them for things that nobody else is looking for. And I appreciate elements of them. And, you know, you go, well, this doesn't make any sense. Well, this and this and this, because that's where my mind went and said, well, clearly this is what makes sense. This must be what they intended. And
that's the most reasonable explanation I've heard. So,
and yet the most terrifying, the most terrifying use the word clearly I've ever heard.
But Kerry Russell was really good in that. And I'm like, I hope this gets her, you know, a career playing mom roles or whatever. And then she vanished again. And then the show shows up. And holy God, is she not only is she a fucking badass just a fucking great actress who's really defined herself. And two, fucking hot as hell. Oh my God.
Okay, there's a scene in the second season that I really felt, you know, it's one of those like, oh my God, oh my God, oh, you poor son of a bitch, where there's a guy who they're trying to like trick, and she's riding on top of him with a wig, and another girl is like kissing him. He's in a three-way, and like the husband and another guy come in pretending to be like CIA agents. Like, don't you realize those girls are probably KGB or somebody trying to get information out of you? And he's like, total nerd. He's probably
I don't care.
He's probably never even been laid, and you're like, you couldn't let him finish.
that was why that scene works, and that's the beauty of it. He's like, have you ever had two women come on to you like that? Well, no. Have you ever had one woman come on to you like that? No. Okay, they're KGB. The show is so good. It's so smart. It's so well written. Every episode is there isn't a bad episode in the lot.
There's not.
And I absolutely love everything about that show. Me and my wife, we blew through it. We blew through the first season, and it was one of those shows where we'd been hearing so much about it. We blew through the first season. It's like, all right, the second season's on. Let's just buy it. And so we bought the first half of the season, blew through those, and then it was waiting week by week as it came out.
Like the rest of us.
Yeah, like the rest of you. Cause I don't have cable. I buy all my shows through, you know, like Amazon.
All right, well, let's move on to another show that you're watching, which is Orphan Black.
Yes.
Came out of nowhere. The amazing... Talk about another female lead.
Don't be so mean to Canada.
Canada. I'll get a beer.
I've actually watched a lot of Canadian shows, and yes, this came out of nowhere.
You know what? There's some things I come across where I go, wow, I love this, and I owe a specific person... for turning me on to it. And Bo, you, thank you very much.
Ha ha!
For pushing this show on.
You turned him on to this?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, Bo really turns him on.
We had an episode where it was like his baby to present this show. Yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, well, it sounds similar to a comic I'm reading. I guess I'll.
And to be fair,
you loaned me your DVDs.
Yeah, okay.
But he was the one who got me.
I did not realize that.
The person who clued me in was Patton Oswalt. He was just like,
Patton Oswalt clued all of us in, because Patton Oswalt was like, oh my God, this show, holy shit, you have to watch the show. And he wouldn't stop talking about it. So it's like, well, Patton keeps going on and on about it. Yeah. Patton's got really good taste on nerd stuff. We got to watch. Oh my God, this show. Yeah, holy shit, this show.
It was Randy who was the first person who told me about it. It was like, you're posting about it. And I was like, how do I not know about this?
I told Randy too. Ha ha.
But this, I talk about your lead actress who's just like owns the show. Tatiana Maslany, who plays almost every character on the show.
Yeah, pretty much.
Aren't there nine Orphan Blacks? Isn't that the thing that we've seen nine of them so far?
Have we?
Well, there have been some that are just referred to, or we've just barely, like, we've seen after they're already dead type of thing.
They're not going to do a Cylon thing where there's like 12 models. Huh? That's all you get.
No, she's like this woman. She plays initially, was it Sarah, right?
Yes.
Who is... Yeah. Kind of a grifter type.
She's a street level hustler and you know, and a bad one at that. She's not even really a hustler. She's like, you know, she's the chick who didn't get along with the parents, ran away from home, had you know, the shitty foster home environment, you know, fallen into low level crime, and is just trying to make it. And she is on a subway platform. She sees a woman who looks exactly like her neatly fold up her possessions and then jump in front of a train. And she's like, what the fuck was that all about? And she goes up to the possessions and her ID and all this stuff is in there. And it's just like, wow, here's another life sitting in front of me. And I look like this woman. I could see.
And she's on the run from some people who are chasing her down.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's like,
boyfriend. Drug dealer boyfriend.
This sounds like a great idea. And you know, it does seem like a great idea until she finds out relatively quickly that, oh, this woman was a cop as well. Uh-oh.
And then she finds out relatively quickly, oh, my God, this woman was a clone.
Yes.
And I'm a clone, too. And so are all of these other clones.
And then they send in the clones.
Yeah. Send in the clones.
Hey, they're here.
I hate that we both went there. God damn it, Chris.
One of the things that like makes this work is just her performance and all these different versions of her, that these different clone characters that are so different from each other and often in the same scene.
Yeah. And it's really nice because, you know, if it was just, you know, you had her street hustler character and then the relatively well put together cop, that would be one thing, or if you even had, like, you know, just two very diametrically opposed people, but instead you get, like, this vast spectrum of people with different character traits, and it's just like, oh, wow, she's really a nuanced actress.
She plays this, you know, she plays this Midwestern scientist lesbian. She plays a, you know, an uptight East Coast housewife. You know, she plays
real uptight.
The British, you know, and the thing is the minute you see her, the minute she walks on screen, you know exactly which character she is.
Right.
Like every time, there's never a moment in the show where you go, shit, wait, which one is she again?
Yeah, I had a harder time like figuring out the cast of Melrose Place in the 90s than I do with her.
My favorite is, though, Helena, who plays a insane assassin trained by a crazy group that is...
A crazy group.
I don't want to be too specific about anything here. But that in the first season is very much her main antagonist. And then the second season, which is where... I feel like things are, they're not quite, it feels like they're not quite sure where they're going with this at some points, but it keeps making such huge decisions for the second season of a show.
Are you caught up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not caught up.
Helena coming back as a sympathetic character.
Oh, I know.
I was like, whoa, that I did not see coming, and they sell it.
I think any of the clones can be sympathetic at this point.
They ostensibly kill that character off at one point.
Yes.
Only to have her come back. And so once you do that, well, you got to make her good.
And there's that added thing where, like, there is a disease that's been popping up with some of the clones where they get sick and die relatively quickly.
They just don't make clones like they used to.
Everyone is trying to say, there's this... You know, the corporation that it was involved in creating them in the first place, that's kind of run, as far as we know, by one of the clones.
Before we keep talking about this,
we haven't actually described the show to anyone who hasn't been watching it.
Yeah, we did.
Yes.
No, we described the setup, but what we never said was what happens.
We haven't described it to Cargill's parameters.
No. What's important to know is that she falls in with all of these other clones, and all of these other clones then try to figure out where the hell they came from, who this organization made them, and why people are trying to kill them.
It's a conspiracy of a clutch of clones.
Yes. Right. And it really is. It becomes one of those things where they're trying to figure out why people are trying to kill them, why some of them are dying off naturally, what's going wrong with these, you know, and why they were made. And as the show unravels, it really is unraveling in a way that it's this big, broad story.
Well, it's also often
broad story.
You're pretty sure one character is evil and working with one, you know, antagonist or the other. And then you find out like, oh no, wait, actually, I think maybe he's a good guy.
Maybe he's
a dupe. Oh no, well, no, he really is working with them. Jesus, I don't know.
Why does that guy have a tail? I don't understand why that guy has a tail.
It's a huge exploration of, you know, the differing motivations, and, you know, you can never be too sure about any of the characters, and that's, you know, that's what keeps you on the edge of the seat, that and you know, this mystery, which hopefully has a good ending, an interesting wrap-up
of what's going on. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Like, it was Lost-level first season brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it really knew exactly the speed at which to dole out big twists to the plot, where it's like, oh, shit, there's a whole nother level to this you didn't see coming. And I think the second season is trying to focus more on emotional connections between these characters, of trying to really get into the depth of who each one of these characters are, which is slowing things down a little bit.
It's something that happens with second season. Like, the first season works so hard to set everything up and make it believable, and the second season... But a lot of shows will coast a little bit because it's kind of like, well, we got it all in place. We'll just kind of spend some time working on all this stuff here. And sometimes it can feel kind of like, all right, guys, make me feel like it's going somewhere. And this very quickly went from like, come on, guys, to, oh, shit. Yeah. Oh, my God. okay, so nobody's safe here.
No, no, nobody is. Yeah, that's the thing, is that you have no idea who's going to make it and who's not. Like,
dude, is that, I mean, the main character's a clone of herself. Of course no one's safe.
I mean,
it's really what they're doing is they're setting up the next TV show, which is Paranoia, which is, you know, setting in the post-apocalyptic world where we all have six clones and our clones can be constantly off. Am I the only one who's played Paranoia in this room? Seriously?
You are not. In fact, I'm going to shoot you in the head right now, which means you get to restart at least five more times.
With five more times. With five more characters, it's all good.
Where does the story take place? Because the accents are all over the place.
And New York.
Like, New York, yeah.
Does it? Is it New
but
York?
But there is people from
all. Because there's so many Brit characters.
Well, I mean, I think part of the reason, well.
Brit characters, but they emigrated to the United States.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's also all filmed in Canada.
Okay, so like my favorite character.
It takes place in Canadian New York, which means it's Vancouver, which means it could be set anywhere.
Yeah. Anywhere. Like, my favorite character outside of the mini clones is Felix, played by Jordan Garavis. And usually, like the over the top gay character can get kind of tiring.
But he's
I never get tired of him
because he is the audience avatar for this show in the sense that he's the guy. He's like, seriously, dealing with all the crazy shit that happens. Like, okay, you know I'm gonna help you because I love you, but this is fucked up.
But you know, it's the thing is they play his homosexuality in a way that we don't normally see on television. And they play him in the way that you'd see, like, it's funny, you know, there's a great theory about Barney from How I Met Your Mother, that what Neil Patrick Harris
is doing. That the actor who plays him is gay?
No. Everybody knows that the actor that plays him is gay, but
what?
That
Neil Patrick Harris is gay?
But that Neil Patrick Harris is playing Barney as the kind of stereotype that straight men play homosexuals in movies.
Yeah. No, honestly, I can bust all that apart because I just heard him interviewed on Howard Stern like a week or so ago. And he asked him about that.
Oh, yeah. Well.
And he's not a feminine guy. He's like, I just didn't grow up that way. I mean, when I played Barney, I'm just really playing him as myself. He just happens to like girls instead of guys. But
anyhow, my point is that he kind of, the great thing about Felix is kind of just this straight up, you know, man whore who just loves other dudes and does in a way that is never offensive and is never as breaking, you know, as falling into stereotypes, but is more falling into, he's just this guy who
he's totally a Samantha.
Yeah. Well, he's very comfortable with himself, but
he is.
What really freaks me out is like, you know, the characters, he's very gay and he's very British. And yet whenever they have breaks and they talk to the actor, he seems to be neither of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the actors in this show are so fucking good.
Yeah.
They're really fucking good. This is an acting show. This is a show you watch for performance.
You can't not, like, immediately. I mean, Tatiana Maslany steals the show, obviously. She's playing so many roles on this. But everybody on it is, in fact, really, really good. And there's, a character, one of the actors I love on the show, who's not going to be on it anymore.
Mm, you better shut up.
Quiet. I have not seen this episode yet. Else. Quiet.
Went out like a dude in the back of a Pulp Fiction car.
I know. Oh, man. You shot Marvin
in the face. You shot Matt Frewer in the face. God, I hope it's not Matt Frewer. I hope it's not Matt Frewer. Dear God, I haven't gotten to that episode yet.
I also hope it's not Matt Frewer either. Yeah, since we're talking about the 80s
his
nostalgia.
His show already got shot in the face.
Well, that sucks, man. Now you're going to watch the episode wondering, who's going to get it? Who's going to get it?
Well, watch the episode. I'm actually several episodes behind, so I have no idea what episode you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm on. I'm starting episode 3 tonight.
Okay.
It's one of those things where right when it came up, we watched the very first episode the night it came in. And, you know, because we're like, oh, it's New Orphan Black. And I play it. And as soon as it's done, Jessica, my wife, just goes, okay, next episode. And I'm like, next week. She's like, what? I have to wait a goddamn week? And it's like, honey, calm down. And she's like, this is why we don't watch shows when they're on. This is why we don't have cable.
We can just go through the show.
I don't have to deal with this. And it's like, and she goes, I want to wait several episodes so we can watch several episodes at a time.
I remember when I lived with you guys the first time and we were watching Lost, we're all like, okay, none of us had watched this. The first season just came out on DVD. Let's all watch this together. And we're like, oh my God. Oh my God. And then the second season started airing and she got so irritated by the fact that her show episode would end and that was it. You couldn't just go next episode.
And she, the thing is what you have to understand about my wife is she's so normally calm and one of the sweetest people in the world.
Completely.
And then she gets frustrated and she's like, I need to watch the rest of the show. And so typically I tend to wait till a series is over before I watch it. In fact, so much so, you know what we started this week? Deadwood.
Oh my God.
It was like, you know, she's like, I want more Justified. I want more Justified. I'm like, you know what, honey? There's a show you need to watch.
I hate to tell you.
No.
But when you get to the end of the available episodes.
I'm well aware of what happens at the end of season 3. And I'm going to prepare her.
There is no next episode available.
I just finished all the available episodes of Mad Men.
I am caught the fuck up.
The end of that.
Well, you haven't watched the newest season, though.
Yes, I am caught the fuck up.
Oh, okay.
I know who's dead. Oh, I know everything.
Oh, that episode is so good.
No, fuck, 2015?
Yeah, I'm with Gargoyle. I was like, I think that last episode is going to be standing up for quite some time as one of the truly all-time great episodes.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, no, I mean, the thing is it's not only a great episode of television, but it's one of those things that the subtext and what they're talking about and what they're calling back to is so great and so awesome that it's so poetic at multiple levels that I'm madly in love with it. It's just the way the last 2 minutes of that episode, I was clutching my chest and I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And Jess, she didn't catch the reference. And so I had to, after the end of the episode, I'm like, come over. And I took her into my office and put on the big screen, the movie in particular
in question.
And played a moment of that. And she's like, oh my God. And then she started tearing up and she's like, that's so beautiful. And I'm like, you're goddamn right. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Oh my God. So heartbreaking. Anyway, speaking of songs, it is time for our show when we take a song break. And this week would have been Ashley's turn, but Ashley couldn't be here.
But fuck Ashley. And I didn't, she's not here.
I didn't want to screw up the order because I have a hard enough time each week remembering whose turn it is anyway.
Okay.
So I was like, you know what? I'll send Cargill an email and say, hey, why don't you pick a song this week? So
that makes sense.
Cargill, take it away.
Well, I don't know how you normally do this, but you asked me what song to pick, and I kind of sat there for 5 minutes and going, what song, you know?
Exactly how we do it.
Yeah. Oh, well, there it is. Well, I was sitting there and I'm like, man, I listen to a lot of crap. And I certainly can't recommend.
For those that don't know, Cargill has the musical taste of a 16-year-old girl.
14-year-old girl. No, I listen to a lot of pop, and I like a lot of pop. I listen to a lot of oddball stuff, too. But, you know, there's a certain level of me that's like, I don't want to be, you know, I'm not, you know, don't want to be too hipster and talk about that kind of stuff.
Well, you were Rickrolling people before it became Rickrolling.
That is,
but
yeah.
You would just do it at karaoke.
You're goddamn right. Until I was really bitter when Never Gonna Give You Up became popular on fucking 4chan, because now I couldn't sing it anymore because I was like, oh, you're Rickrolling us. It's like, fuck,
like,
you.
No!
This song is good. Rick Astley was a musical genius. God damn it.
No.
So I figured I would go with Busting Up a Starbucks by Mike Doty. Mike Doty being one of my favorite musicians out there. The only musician that I follow on Twitter who I've never met, you know, never, you know, had an encounter with in my life. I've seen him perform, you know, half a dozen times. I absolutely love him. He was the lead singer of Soul Coughing. He was, he used to go under the name M. Doty. He was also a poet. And now he performs under his own, under the name Mike Doty and the Mike Doty Band on occasion.
Which is doing a lot of stuff that is like, you know, in structure, very Soul Coughing-ish still, but in production, not.
Well, you see very much where Mike Doty's influence on Soul Coughing came from, and then you see where the influence of the other guys came from.
Yes.
And you see, and the thing is what I love about Soul Coughing is very much what I loved about, you know, what I love about Mike Doty.
For the record, you guys out there, the three main Soul Coughing albums.
The three only Soul Coughing
albums.
Well,
I think there was a live one at some point or something like that, and I think there was even a Greatest Hits album too that they put together, but the three primary albums are all phenomenal and totally worth buying and so great, especially El Oso, the last one.
I love El Oso, but I think their previous albums are actually slightly better.
Two of the two best songs they ever did are both on their first album, but other than that, I thought as a whole album I liked El Oso the best.
El Oso is the one that had the most hits off it. You know, the previous one only had Super Bon Bon become a hit, and then El Oso had two or three hits.
Circles.
Yeah. But it's but yeah, I really dug Soul Coughing, but I really love Mike Doty, and I love him as an artist, and I love what he's been doing. He's been very experimental. In fact, he did this really cool thing. My wife loves him just as much as I do, and so for her birthday last year, I noticed several months before her birthday that he was offering a thing where you could pay to have him play a song live and record it on an MP3 recorder. And, like the first song was like $99 and it was $150 for two. And then, you know, $279 for three, like they were really oddball numbers. But so I ended up buying her an MP3 recorder with four songs on it. And so each one would include your name and the date that he played it. And he would sit there and play you a live song. And so I got her, I sneakily, you know, just started playing Mike Doty songs on my computer and like, hey baby, what would you say your favorite Mike Doty songs are? And so started up that conversation. She's like, oh, well, and she told me what her favorite ones were. And so those were the ones I submitted. And so I got an MP3 player, you know, just one of those little like recorders.
Yeah.
It was like an old tape recorder, but with MP3s on it. And he sent it and it's autographed on the back
nice.
Yeah, it was a really cool thing. It was one of those things. It was like $350, but for one of your favorite musical artists to send you four songs played for you where you're mentioned on the tracks.
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, he included five tracks because on one of the tracks he started playing and he's like, he started playing the wrong song. And he's like, oh, Jessica, that's what we call a fuck up. And in the music industry, and I'm a professional and I'm not cool with that. So we're going to move on to we're going to do that again. But he included
Jessica,
the fuck up.
We know your husband's writing Dr. Strange, Dr. Strange, Dr. Strange.
Would you guys stop it? Oh, for fuck's sake.
You heard it here first, folks.
Oh my God. You did not hear it here first. Oh my God. Marvel has made no decisions on the writing of Doctor Strange.
He's writing Doctor Strange, writing Doctor Strange, Strange, Strange.
Anyhow.
The strange days.
So the song I chose from Mike Doty is not so strange. It's track 4 off Haughty Melodic. It's called Bustin' Up a Starbucks.
I thought it was going to be called Sanctum Sanctorum.
I love the hell out of Haughty Melodic, but I really do love Bustin' Up a Starbucks. It's really cool song, and here it is.
It will always be the end of time, the end of the law, the end of life. The dolls will tree to tree, from each to each. And does the man who made the shoes own you, clown? You can't even buy the nameplate off. No, can you fix it with your tiny pistola? James Van Der Beek and them sisters from Sister Sister, the only one. Like busting up a Starbucks, busting up a Starbucks, busting up a Starbucks, busting up a Starbucks. This bitter drink has made you drunk. The thoughts you think become unthunk. Seas of blazing, the sky is too, the water's red, and the flames are blue. Does the man who made the shoes own you, clown? You can't even buy the nameplate off. Now can you fix it with your tiny pistol? Sister, sister, the only one that's ever felt this is you, the force that's forcing you to feel like busting up a Starbucks, busting up a Starbucks, busting up a Starbucks,
I love that song. That is one of my favorite solo Mike Doty pieces. Definitely.
It's a really great song. There's a number of great songs that he's done, but yeah, that's when what comes to mind is the one that I really adore is Busting Up a Starbucks. It's so him, the poetry of what he does combined with, you know, just the melodic nature of everything he does. It's one of those rhythmic songs that you just follow along with. And when you're listening to it at the same time, it doesn't totally make conscious sense, and at the same time, it makes this poetic sense that I just absolutely love.
Well, now that we're back, we have to We have to do the inevitable, which is talk about the fact that Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
C. Robert Cargill of the Connecticut Cargills. Yes, yes, I see.
Has a new book out that is the sequel to his previous book, Dreams and Shadows, called Queen of the Dark Things. This is now, in fact, available. You can get it on Amazon.com. And if you look on the post of this, there'll actually be a buy link, so you can actually buy it right through us there, and we get a little kickback. So, you know.
And we all get a little kickback from that, I believe. I believe that's how that works.
Don't promise that.
Cargill might get the biggest kickback.
I think he gets the biggest kickback, yes. But why don't you talk a little bit about Queen of the Dark Things, Cargill?
Well, for those of you that don't know about Dreams and Shadows is a story of, you know, a young boy who makes a wish with a genie to see, you know, the supernatural world as it is and as it exists around us, and all the how that fucks up his life. And Queen of the Dark Things is...
Constantine was there to say, don't do it!
Well, no, in fact, that's the thing, is that, you know, part of, you know, I gotta say, part of what inspired this whole story was very much, you know, things like Constantine and Doctor Strange and things of that nature that I read growing up, that, you know, there's, you know, the idea that there's this whole world out there, and you have this whole, you know, kind of portal fantasy kind of story element where, you know, a young child goes into, you know, the strange world and then has this quirky adventure through it. And I was like, I wanted to tell a story about kids who are caught up in a truly fucked up, dark, supernatural world and what it would really, you know, kind of conceptually do to your psyche. And so, Queen of the Dark Things takes place 6 months after, Dreams and Shadows. And it's all about Colby, trying to deal with, all the shit that's just happened, while at the same time being confronted by something that also comes from his past and introduces us to what happened in his childhood during a period of time that we don't see during Dreams and Shadows, and how that now comes back to haunt him.
I do like how in Dreams and Shadows, we see the young Colby, and then it skips ahead to where he's an adult, and he's dealing with the fallout from what he did when he was younger. But there's that mention of like, yeah, all this shit happened in between that we didn't see. And here we get a glimpse of what happened. And these books are like an intricate clockwork where things are happening. And it's always being to the main character, Colby, or whoever, the kids are being told like, well, this is happening because of this decision you made back here. And it affects all these things that you couldn't see that. And really, when you read it, it's like, actually, there was shit in the works before this kid even came along. I don't feel like he had the choice that you guys are trying to tell him that he had. It's just the way things have gone and they're going to go. And it's like, it's not really destiny, but it kind of is.
It's it's not all going to make total sense until the end of the third book.
Yes. Well, really?
Yeah. No, there are three books. The third book, is the one that I'm putting together now. I've always known how it ended. And then while writing the second book, I found out how it ended better. Uh-huh. And I told that ending to my wife, and my wife squeed and clapped and was like, oh, my God, that's the end of the book. And now every time the idea of that book comes up, she gets really giddy and can't wait to tell people about it, but knows that she can't.
And I think there's a difference between, like, the idea of destiny and the idea of inevitability. I mean, whereas there is so this is pre – it's not necessarily that it's preordained, but – if you hit this particular domino, it's going to end up with that domino down there falling over.
Well, there's actually large discussions of that in the second book, and that's very the second book is very much about destiny in that, and the way one of the characters describes it is you know, it's kind of like a billabong, because, of course, much of the second
because
book...
Because you're a big Australian fetishist by now.
Well, but the second book takes place largely in Australia. You know, it's about his childhood, on walkabout with a clever man. And he explains that, you know, destiny is like a billabong. You know, it's a place where you know that when it rains, the rain is going to land and the rain is going to collect. That's what destiny is. You can carve out a separate section and the rain will collect something somewhere else. But unless you forcibly do something about it, you know where that rain is going to fall. And that's very much what understanding destiny is. It's not really actually seeing the future. It's understanding the future.
The same way that the inventors of the billabong knew that eventually they would be the tagline for a successful series of server clothing.
Yes.
No. I knew. I was like, I know that's where he's going. A child of the 80s, of course, is going to be.
And then the world is consumed by a giant pair of board shorts.
The third book is all about Ocean Pacific.
In fact, I haven't said this publicly, but would you guys like to know what the working title of the third book is?
Please let me know. I don't.
Okay. Well,
I
then
do.
We won't
shut up, Martin.
I'm.
You plug your ears.
How far are you into Queen of the Dark Things?
Here's the thing. Your first book, which is brilliant in ways that I could not have imagined before. I read it slowly. I would savor each chapter, read some, and just like want to go on, but go like, no. I want this for the next time. I have a break, and I stretched it out.
You're driving me crazy.
I was stretching out because I reached that point when I got three quarters of the way into it. Well, no, two thirds of the way, and I realized, wait, everything I'm reading now is getting me closer to it being over, and I didn't want to reach that point. But finally, once you get, there's a certain point you hit where it's like, there's no stopping now. I
got
to
get going. Yeah, I got to find out what happens.
We are polar opposites because I'm like, what's going to happen at the end?
Yeah. Now, I'm like, I'm sick, work.
Yeah.
Well, now with Queen of the Dark Things, I was hoping to do that. But once we get to the pass to Australia, man, it's just a real joy for me. Like anytime I have a break and I can read. So I'm at that two thirds point right now in it. I don't want to give anything away of where I am. I'll tell you after this.
Not around me, you won't.
You know I talk about what a big fan I am of your writing. I think it's brilliant. For me personally, and this won't be a popular opinion, it's like reading Neil Gaiman, like the best of Neil Gaiman, without all the Britishness or the writer trying to impress me with how smart he is getting in the way.
I mean, what he's saying is, you're not British or smart.
I'm the dumb American Neil Gaiman.
You are.
I'm putting that on every book from here on out.
The bumpkin version of Neil Gaiman.
No. You're just as smart. You just aren't trying to make me, you aren't trying to push that in my face.
My name's Jethro Gaiman. I'm going to tell y'all a story.
Jethro Gaiman.
If you'll set a spell.
Hey, you know what? They'll tell you from having read the books. I love the word spell this time. So,
all right. So you need to plug your ears for a second, apparently, because this is a monetized website and he just offered to give new information he's never said publicly. So you can shut the hell up.
There might have been two or three people out there who have heard the
Cargill. What is the potential title of the third book?
The Coyote Laughs Last.
Okay. All right. There you go. New information.
Anyone who's gotten to the end of the second book is just like, oh my god, like they freak out. So Oh yeah, you're two thirds of the way through the book, you have no idea what I'm about to do to you, my friend.
That's the whole thing with Coyote, because you know what he does with the first book, the way he's that kind of sly, wow, what a dick, and then to come at the end and just go like, yes, this is why I set this in motion. I was like, oh my god. This makes this whole book. This is like when you watch that movie Hero, and you get to the end where Jet Li has made it to the big emperor he's supposed to kill. And he goes like, yeah, I conquered all these places because they're a bunch of little assholes who were all fighting each other. I wanted to make one united China. You're like, oh, well, now you put it that way.
Well, shit. You mean what do you mean we're going to have peace for 2,000 years? I'm going to be one united country that doesn't kill each other.
Yeah.
Oh, god damn it. Fuck.
By the way, kids, better start learning Chinese now.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is I'm not what's called a pantser. I don't like sitting down and writing and seeing where it goes. I don't sit down and write anything until I know the ending of it. Mm-hmm. And so all of my books are written with an ending in mind. And when I realized while I was writing Dreams and Shadows, one of my buddies who's a fantasy writer is like, you know, the first thing they're going to ask you is, can we make this into a series? And I was like, well, I kind of had it envisioned as one book. And he's like, well, you need to consider that because they'll ask you and that may make a decision on whether they buy it or not.
Well, stop it.
And so I started thinking about it. I was like, well, there's actually... And I started thinking about it, and then it started gnawing at me, and I'm like, oh, my God. And then all of a sudden, I had an idea for three books, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and I knew the exact story I wanted to tell. I'm like, I know how to do this and set this up. And so when I went in, I did five meetings. You know, I have this brilliant rock star agent who just got me, like, in this crazy amount of meetings in a very short amount of time. And most of the meetings, you could tell, I could tell within the first 10 minutes, they just wanted to talk to me and they wanted to keep their relationship with my agent. And at the same time, they were also, you know, like, Ain't It Cool News fans. I had a couple guys who were like, who spent 15 minutes talking to me about what it was like to write for Ain't It Cool News.
Yeah.
And once they were doing that, I was like, oh yeah, these guys don't want to buy the book. Yeah, but there were a couple of people that did, and one of the teams that did was Harper Voyager, who ended up buying it, and I knew they were serious because at the meeting, you know, it's the editor who became my editor, and then the head of publicity, and then, you know, one of the other editors, and I was like meeting with a group of people, and one of the first things they asked me is they go, is there more than one book in this? Mm-hmm. And then I knew they were serious. Yeah. And I was like, actually, I have an idea for three. And they're like, okay. And they ended up buying it. And they ended up buying a two-book deal to make sure that I could write a second book. And so, but there's an idea. The concept for the third book. And the third book kind of wraps up everything. But I've been writing towards that. And like, if you read Dreams and Shadows, there's some hints at the Australian stuff in the first book. And, you know, you've read the book. There's the moment where he and Ewan are going to meet the dwarf out in the hill country, and he's singing song lines. Yeah. And so we learn in the second book.
Is he singing I Come From a Land Down Under?
No, he's not singing Men at Work. He's singing
Men Without Pants.
Yes, and the idea of song lines is fully introduced there, but if you go back and read the first book after having read the second, there's several little references within that first book that totally make sense once you've read the second. And there's several things in the second book that will make much more sense when and if you read the third book. And that's what I've been working to the whole time, is telling this whole arc.
Which will be an Australian gothic novel called London After Midnight Oil.
I asked you the other day if you'd ever read any of the Iron Druid stuff.
And I love those books.
I love those too.
Well, the thing is, it also features you know, the
Coyote.
Coyote appears. Hero is a redhead magic user, and he has a dog who talks to him.
That, you know, he keeps coming up in a number of ways. That guy, and I'm blanking on his name all of a sudden. It's
I'm blanking on his name.
Me too. And yeah, I've just been listening to the second.
I got turned on to him by a Spill fan.
Apparently,
and then I turned you on to him.
Apparently, he's the best friend of every fantasy writer in the world. Like, everybody loves this guy. He's one of the sweetest, nicest guys in the world. I've never met him, despite all the conventions I go to. He and I have never run into each other.
Kevin Hearn.
Kevin Hearn. Kevin Hearn. And everybody loves him. Apparently he is like one of the best guys in the universe. And that came up because in the second book, in Queen of the Dark Things, there's a talking dog.
And it's funny because I started reading Queen of the Dark Things, but I also started listening to, I was going on walks and I was listening to the second of the Iron Druid books with, you know, and I was like, oh wow, this parallel is even, you know, more than I thought. But the more I get into both of them, the more they really start to split off. Iron Druid books almost feel like your books are the movie, and then they did the Iron Druid as a TV series.
It's the television series.
From what I understand, the dog in Iron Druid is still very much a dog.
Yeah.
Yes. And the dog in Queen of the Dark Things is a familiar.
Part of the fun thing in the Iron Druid Chronicles is that the way that the audiobooks, which is how I listen to them as well, is that they play the dog so much as like
comic relief.
He's comic relief.
He's a familiar also, but he plays a much bigger part in the Iron Druid books than your dog plays in
here. And as well, I'm sure you get a lot of people asking about the Dresden Files, you know, which is another one of those urban fantasy.
Jim Butcher, yeah.
By Jim Butcher, which I'm a fanatic for. I love that series. And I was like one of those guys, like, I am never going to get into a long-term series again. I just don't have enough time in the day for it. And fucking...
He's on what, like book 14?
Fucking Harris. Like, it was like, dude... Seriously, you need to read those. And I'm going to tell you, the first two books are just okay. They're fun. You'll have a good time with them. But when you get to book three, you will just be cracking out for the next one. And now, he was absolutely right.
Now, I don't know how much of this is true, but the story I've heard, the story around the campfire, is that Jim Butcher had much higher aspirations. He wanted to write literature, as we all do, as all writers do when you get in. Like, I want to write literature. Yeah, and he had a particular writing professor who just gave him a really hard time about his writing, and he said, "Fuck you! I'm just going to write the most crass, manipulative, upfront, you know, commercial piece I can write that is what inspires me." And he wrote the first bits that were that would become his very first Dresden Files. And the professor was like, "Oh my God, this is so good." And the reaction was just great. And he's just like, "Well, shit, I found it." And
wait, are you saying that writing commercial manipulative stuff actually succeeds?
People connect with it.
14.
Now, I don't know how much of that is true, but
14 enormous bestsellers later. Yeah. It's like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. No. And he's really built his career on that. And from what I hear, it's really great. I have not read any of the Butcher stuff. I hear they're a lot of fun.
I actually keep hearing from people the audiobooks are among the best of the audiobooks recorded for that type of stuff that's out there, and I have not listened to them, so maybe, Martin, that's something you might want to look into. Because
I was talking with friends who would, like, a guy who was recommending the Iron Druid books to me, and I was like, "Oh, you're too late. Somebody already told me about it."
Yeah.
But then he started talking about the Dresden.
Yeah, it's totally worth it.
And don't get me wrong, I mean, I'd love to write, you know, The Corrections or something along those lines, but if I had the choice between Jonathan Franzen's money and that chick who wrote Twilight's money, I guess which one I'm going for.
You know, what finally sold me on reading it was I've just scrolling through Facebook and somebody posted a, you know, fan art picture of like him on top of a zombie type T-Rex throwing fireballs.
That's sold.
And it said the Dresden Files. Yeah, it's kind of like that. And I was like, I'm in.
I'm done.
And by the time I got to that book, which is like 7 or 8, I was like, just like, oh, this is, why can't they make this into a movie now?
Because they made it into a TV series and failed miserably.
It was awful. It was awful.
Yeah, it was not a good series.
Let me ask you a question about your books. I know there's a character in the second book who is based on a real life person. It was based on a movie critic here in Austin. Should I say his name or would that be
go weird? For it. No. It was I actually told him a year and a half ago that I was working on a book and that there was a character in the book inspired by it.
Mark Savlov. I just didn't want to.
Oh yeah. I could totally read someone from Mark Savlov.
I
was like, why don't you just use his name?
Because I didn't have permission. I didn't want and really I didn't want permission. I wanted to be able to write about Savlov the way I wanted to write about Savlov because I love Mark Savlov.
I do too. Yeah.
One of the
who's in Thailand now while there's a revolution going on.
While there's a revolution going on, and why is he there? To experience the punk scene and to get fucking married to a punk Thai girl.
She's not Thailand. She's not Thai.
Is she not?
No. She's I don't know if she's American, but she's a white girl.
Oh, the picture I saw, I thought she was Thai.
No. She may have been with somebody else, but no, I met her. She was in a movie live right before we left.
Okay. Well, then I'm off on that. But the Mark Savlov is one of those, everybody has the most interesting guy you know. And, you know, I have one of those careers where I, you know, I work in Hollywood and I'm working here in the Austin blogger scene, and I know a lot of interesting people. And yet Mark Savlov is still that dude that's just like, fuck it, I'm going to take a year sabbatical and go experience the punk scene in Thailand.
Yeah, and write a book about it.
And write a book about it. And so,
however, he does not drink Dos Equis.
No. No, I do. I don't always drink beer, but when I do, something, 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 something.
One of the most interesting
But yeah, no, I did. I did actually loosely base a character in loosely.
No, but the question.
I think that should be read at his funeral as an obituary,
right?
Did you guys think it was a positive view of Mark?
It was.
I mean, that's what I intended it as, but Mark, I didn't also want to, you know, fillet my friend
Mark,
in a book.
He's a character.
He is.
Yeah. Which is to say, like, in terms of, like, someone like Hunter S. Thompson.
Yes,
you're going,
exactly.
You're going, look.
That's why I brought us Hunter S. Thompson in that section.
There's going to be people who are going to meet Mark Savlov and go, I can't stand that fucking guy. And there's going to be people who are like...
And those people are boring and fuck them.
And there's going to be people who are like, that guy
he's
is fascinating.
Nice to me.
Yeah, he's...
No, he's the sweetest guy in the world. He's interesting. He's been around. Yes. No one knows exactly how old he is.
No.
No one knows how long he's been around, but they know he's been around since the punk scene in Austin in the 80s. So he's old enough for that, but he's young enough to still wear clothes that are fucking 5 minutes ahead of what everyone else is going to be wearing.
He looks exactly the same as when I met him in 1992.
Yes.
Exactly.
Oh my God. I mean, he's the guy is a fucking vampire. I swear to God, he's fucking Lestat.
He's wearing the same punk clothes he was wearing in 1992.
And they're still fucking cool. No, he's and this guy has been a film critic in Austin for a long time, and he's a friend of all of ours. But he is such an interesting dude. And so when it came time to write a character in, you know, in this book, that was the guy who was writing about, you know, Ewan and what happens to Ewan in the first book. Of course, it had to be, you know, this universe's version of Mark Savlov.
Right.
And so I have this guy show up, and most people aren't going to even recognize what this thing is. And they're just going to think it's a little character in a book. But anyone from Austin just giggles and goes, that's Mark Savlov.
I guess what I have to ask you is, are there in either one of those two books or in your plans for any upcoming things, any characters based on any of your other friends?
You may have, Chris, I'm going to tell you, you may or may not have appeared in Dreams and Shadows, and you may or may not have liked it.
And then there's another guy who really likes kitty cats.
Yeah, that would be that's always.
And his black friend.
That's always the clue to me. I'm like, wait, the guy loves cats, drinks a lot of beer, and his best friend is a black dude with a shaved head?
That's me, right? I'm just saying you may or may not have appeared. Since we may or may not have lived together for 2.5 years, you may or may not be there. I don't know.
Now I gotta go back and reread Dreams
may or
and
may
Shadows.
Not be flattering.
I was the big hairy guy that stole the kid in first chapter. Did you like that?
Yeah.
That's kind of a hobby.
Spoilers, don't ruin the first chapter of the first book.
Oh, fuck you. It's 5 pages.
Bonefoot. All right.
By the way, you have this knack of doing this thing where you go on with the story, and when I have a question like, wait, why is this particular thing going on? And then you'll answer it later. Not at front, you don't set it up. It's just somehow later, almost randomly, but right when I'm really want to know, you provide the answer.
You know,
how is that watermelon
doing now?
Okay, look, here's the guy.
Because I read so much of the first book when I was like, wait, why did the genie grant his wish in the first place?
Oh.
And then, boom.
The thing is that, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer. I figured out that I wanted to be a writer when I was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. I was a big fan. In fact, here's the true story. The true story of how I became a writer is this. I was 8 years old, and I had a huge crush on Drew Barrymore.
Me and
Drew Barrymore are the exact same age. I had seen E.T. I had seen an episode that she'd done of the Ray Bradbury TV show.
Wow, you miss being a Coke dealer by that much.
And I was just like, you know, heart goes pitter-patter. This young girl, she is, oh my God, she's so cute. and I want to see her next movie. Mom, Dad, take me to see this movie. Please take me to see this. Mom, Dad, please take me to see this movie. I want to see this movie. We are not taking you to see a Stephen King movie. And it's Firestarter, and they won't take me to see it, and I won't shut up about goddamn Firestarter.
Didn't you talk about at some point being involved in a Firestarter remake?
Or starting fires.
Oh, dude.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Come on, dude.
That never happened.
I thought that was a long
time ago. It was a long time ago, and it never happened.
Dude, I'm a David Keith type. Come on.
So
make the fucking movie.
So,
and I'm a Keith David type.
You really are. Keith David, David Keith. Forget what fucking Chris said. Ha! So I really, 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 really fucking want to see this movie, and my parents won't take me, and my aunt knows. And my aunt, who's 5 years older than me, she's 14 years old, or 13 years old, is just like, well, I'm going to buy my nephew, because I have a nephew. I'm 13 years old, and I have a nephew. And she's like, I'm going to buy him the book. And she gives me the book for Christmas. And my parents are like, you gave our son a Stephen King. And I was just like, he's 8 years old. He's not going to read it. I read that motherfucker 3 times. And I read it cover to cover. And by the third time I'm reading it, I'm like, hey, the Stephen King guy, this is what he does for a job. He writes this cool shit.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. And so from the time I was 8, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And I tried writing novels in my early 20s. I wasn't ready. And I had a nightmare of an agent situation that just went south. And I think actually on the old site, on the original, on the Gentleman Show, I think I talked part about that, which led up to the whole meeting Neil Gaiman and having, yes, you know, an occurrence with Neil Gaiman thing, in which you suggested that I was bitten by a radioactive spider of suck, which, by the way,
why he never forgot
which,
that.
Which I was going to say, which is not the worst insult or backhanded compliment you've dealt, but the fact that he remembered it.
he was just bitten by Neil Gaiman, who is
no, radioactive. I quoted that wrong. It was a radioactive spider of kiss ass. Is what the comment was.
Oh, yes. It's different.
Yeah, it's a little different. But anyhow, so,
I'm sorry. That's actually really funny.
It's really funny. It was a funny joke, which is why I remembered it. It's not because I'm bitter. It's because I'm like, God damn it, that was fucking good. And it's one of the best digs anyone's ever taken at me. And it's awesome. And I wasn't able, because I was in the middle of a great story.
We do
at the time.
What we can here.
No, I was in the middle of a story that was like, by the time you get to the end of the story, you're like, fuck, you turn off the mic, you're like, God damn it, everybody's going to really like that story. But it was one of those, you know, I had this crushing defeat and I'm like, I'm never going to be a novelist. And right after that was when Eric Vespi came to me and said, hey, we've been reading your stuff on the site. I'd really like it if you came over to Ain't It Cool News and started writing. And that became my career for 10 years. And so what I always did while I was as a film critic, the whole time I was working with you guys, while I was working with Ain't It Cool, what I was doing was studying story.
Yeah.
And every time I would be reviewing, I considered that as if I were writing an essay or giving an oral presentation on storytelling, for, you know, this grand dissertation that I would one day have. And, are we out of beer? Oh my God. I have to drink whiskey instead.
It's
actually
rum, but
rum. Okay. So it's not the really bad whiskey that you almost fed Martin.
Sailor Jerry's. It'll work.
It works. Okay. So yeah, but what happened was I spent 10 years as a critic trying to learn how to tell a story and learning how people did it right and watching the audience and watching the critics' reaction and then learning how people did it wrong. And so when I set out to write Sinister, I set out as Sinister was my grand thesis of that 10 years. It was not, hey, this is what I'm, this is me trying to show myself as a badass. It was me writing the story to show everything that I had learned and see if it worked.
Right.
And so when I wrote the books, it was very much that same thing. It was very much, here's me trying to tell a story in the way that I've learned from you guys for the last 10 years. Every comment that ever was posted on one of my reviews, every comment on one of our reviews over at Spill, you know, it was all of that built up to this.
And the Happy Feet comments?
I learned more from Happy Feet than any other review I ever made.
Because
keep in mind, the Happy Feet was a joke.
Look, honestly,
you know, the Happy Feet was satire, and that was me dabbling my feet into the notion of what, of clickbaiting and of satire. Because you guys, for those of you that don't know, what happened was I saw Happy Feet, and Happy Feet, I was like, Well, that was kind of a crappy movie, but
I'm not a fan either for that.
Yeah,
for
that. I love that movie. It wasn't a very good movie, but it was one of those things where I was like, well, no, but it was one of those things where I was like, as green and ecologically minded as I am, I'm like, fuck, that movie was so far to the left. Like, that movie makes me, as somebody who's very green, feel like, shit, I'm really I'm really conservative compared to you. You're really fucking out there. You, like, want us to stop fishing, period. And I was just like, that was really weird. And the more I thought about it, I was like, God, that movie was really, really ultra-liberal in a way that's kind of offensive. And then I was like, there's three ways I can review this. I can review this the Roger Ebert way, which is where I write a 500, you know, word review of how pretty the icebergs are and how the songs kind of bored me because I already knew them and they were performed better by their original singers.
Boring.
Or I could write, and I thought, I was like, I could write this balanced review where it was two angels, an angel and a devil on my shoulder, talking about how if you go this way, you'll get, you know, a lot of interest in people talking and referring to your review, and how if you go this way, if you're honest, you know, maybe you shouldn't be talking about the politics of what this movie was trying to say, but maybe this movie shouldn't be so political and geared towards seven-year-olds. And then there was part of me that the third version, which is like, why don't you write a satire piece in which you pretend to be a right-wing asshole being totally offended by this fucking movie? And so I was like, that would be funny. Like, people will get the satire of that. Yeah. And they did it. Like, the handful of people that got the satire of the thing thought it was hilarious and passed it around like, oh my God, this fucking thing is hilarious. But then the people on the left were like, oh my God, this jackboot-wearing, fox-watching fucking right-wing conservative is the devil. And the right-wingers were like, thank you for being so fucking brave in a liberal world. And I was like, oh my God.
I don't want either response.
And the thing is I really learned from that review, I was like, there is a real market for being angry and getting people angry on the internet. Like, there's a real market there. And this was before this had become a thing.
You were 2 seconds away from being a writer for The Onion.
No. Well, but I was, or being a writer for Fox News, I realized that I could be that weird conservative voice to the right that was bashing on liberal Hollywood and make a shit ton of money.
Yeah, I'm firmly convinced that 90% of those folks, Dennis Miller, they have that opportunity and they give in to that. They're like, fuck, I can make a lot of money doing
this. I could keep my soul. Right. And I was, and you guys know me, and I was just like, I can't. And you remember, Martin, because we had that conversation afterwards, because you knew I was like, I was bothered by certain elements because I thought it was too far and that children shouldn't be exposed to political thought that young. But at the same time, I was like, because I remember I told you, I was like, you need to take your girls to see Happy Feet because that is exactly this is how you need to, the way you're teaching your girls, Happy Feet is for your girls. But, you know, for my sister's children, oh my God, it's the wrong fucking movie. Well, my sister's going to lose her shit.
Thing, though, it's like the whole Dr. Spock thing of like, you know, you can do anything with a child as long as you play with them. And this is what a good number of the animated films that are out there, do.
What does the science officer know about raising children?
Doctors.
Officers. Anyhow, so what ended up happening was it taught me, I learned a lot from that, and I realized that I could go one way and make a lot of money being that guy, or I could keep my soul, and that's where I swung more to being the centrist that I really am, in which I, you know, you guys know me, I'm a militant centrist. It's like, I'm right here in the middle. It's like, funny. Fuck you on the left, fuck you on the right, I'm going to guard the middle and protect it from you crazies.
It's funny how many times we've had, like, political arguments, like, and then eventually it gets to a point, a lot of the time where I'm like, I hate to admit it, but I want to go full-blown liberal on you, but you have a very solid point there.
The trick is just not to engage him. Just let him be wrong over there.
I like to think of myself as a moderate, but I know I'm like much more towards.
Oh yeah, no, you're not a centrist, friend.
But you make a lot of like solid points with that. So where I've had to come back around, you and I've got a couple other friends who are the same way, who are less centrist than you, are more toward the right, but still reasonable. And it's like, okay, I admit, like, you got to get out of your comfort zone sometimes and go, oh, I respect this guy, and I'm going to listen to what he's saying, and he makes a lot of good points. point.
But
I got to change my perspective.
I learned a lot from that. That was, I mean, because this is, and what I've viewed of the internet in the 8 years since that happened, I've watched how the internet swung making the decision I didn't make, where it's, oh, look, most sites are, hey, let's write a reactionary piece because a reactionary piece will get people talking. It doesn't matter if we're right. It matters if we get clicks. And which is counter to what I always operated under, which is it doesn't matter if I'm right. It matters if I make people think. And they kind of sway away from the making people think and go more towards the clicks. And that's where the internet has gone terribly wrong.
I'm just looking forward to Rush Limbaugh's impassioned defense of Slender Man at this
point. Oh, dear God. Oh, fuck.
Which
that
isn't
story.
To say there's a problem with Slender Man. It's just the, yes. Anyway, let's move on.
Moving right
We're
along.
Being
so
serious.
So Queen of the Dark Things, it's out now. Please, I would love it. If you haven't read Dreams and Shadows, it's out there. It's available. It's anywhere you buy books, you can find it. It's in paperback. It's on Kindle. It's on iBook.
Buy it from our link on Amazon. It'll please help oneofus.net out too. It'll help Cargill out. It's just a win-win situation.
Ah, fuck helping Cargill out or helping oneofus.net out. Help yourself out because these are fantastic books.
Yes.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Agreed. But let's move on to our main topic, which is, you know what? We all just saw the X-Men Days of Future Past.
Did we?
Yes, we did.
I saw it.
You saw it.
I totally saw it.
Wait, this is our main topic?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Wait. You motherfucker, I thought I was the main topic. God damn it. You brought me in for an X-Men episode? Fuck you.
You're the sub-main topic.
You're not going to let me talk about Chris Claremont, God damn it.
You know we have no choice. You're going to talk about Chris Claremont.
We have to talk about Chris Claremont.
Now, this is a spoiler sequence. So if you have not seen X-Men Days of Future Past, if you're not currently caught up on all the Marvel films that have come out, if you're not caught up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and that bothers you that you're not, then...
And we will probably talk about Agents of fucking S.H.I.E.L.D. because it's awesome.
You know what? If there was ever a show that turned its shit around halfway through a season, it's that one.
Well, this is why I stick with shows and people are like, why are you still watching that?
Yeah.
I'm like, because it could turn around.
Most of Joss Whedon's shows are like that. I mean, for fuck's sake, talk to any fucking Buffy fan. Any Buffy fan, pull them aside and say, I've never watched Buffy, and they'll say the same goddamn thing. Well, the first season and a half isn't so great. But once you get into the second half of the second season, oh my God, that show becomes awesome, and it's awesome all the way to the end.
Yeah.
Every single fucking Buffy fan says that. And
Dollhouse, not so much, but still.
But this time... This Firefly, his best show ever, which is only 13 episodes long. It takes.
You were not a Buffy fan when I met you.
No, I hate it. And I still don't like Buffy, but I love Firefly. But I'm watching it. And for the first few episodes, I'm like, why is everybody telling me to watch this fucking show? It's all right. It's not as great as it is. By the time I get to the fourth episode, I'm like, I can't wait to watch more of the show. This show is the best show ever. Why is there only 13 episodes? Fuck you, Fox. And I joined the screaming hordes of please bring Firefly back. And then I watched, you know, the movie, and I'm like, oh my God, this movie's amazing.
But you had enough, like, okay, I see how Whedon works, and he sets stuff up, and he sets up your expectations, and then when it sells is when he undercuts all those expectations.
And that's exactly what he does with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yes. And that's why I stuck with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Everybody's like, you're still watching that? And I'm tweeting or Facebooking every once in a while. Am I the only one still watching the show? Because I'm actually enjoying it. It's not great, but it's good. And then when Captain America happens...
Yeah, once the Winter Soldier
came out,
it had a big turnaround.
Yeah. And that show went from being, I enjoy the show every week, to, oh my God, I cannot wait for next week, holy fuck. And my wife, who I had to twist her fucking arm to watch those early episodes, like, she was just like, I'm really not into the show, honey. And I'm like, shut up and watch it! Just watch the fucking show! You know, she finally got to the point where she would ask me every day, she's like, is there new episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? And I'm like, are you asking me about that show you didn't want to watch? Shut up. Is there a new episode? No, there's not.
Yeah,
it comes
she was
out.
Asking because she was getting divorce papers ready.
Watch your fucking show, goddammit! Watch your fucking show!
Well, that's the thing, is like, that show does find its turnaround point, and it takes, it pretty much takes everything that was irritating people about the first... several episodes.
You mean the setup?
And goes, yeah, this was the plan the whole time, was to undercut all the shit that you hate and find a way to make it work.
It did it in such a way where normally I might say to people when this kind of thing happens, like, oh, go ahead and skip all this. Like,
we're in the spoiler episode. Let's stop being like vague about it. When Hydra shows up.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, sorry, when Hydra shows up. But it's one of those where, like, even before Hydra showed up, the show started to get better. It wasn't really good, but it was better.
It was improving.
Yeah, and I would say to people, like, okay, well, you can probably skip, like, watch the first episode and then skip the next 6 to 8 episodes.
No, because then you skip The Eye, and The Eye was their first really good episode.
The Eye? Which one was The Eye?
The one where there's the woman who is an ex-SHIELD agent going around doing fucked up shit, and it was because The Eye, you know, she was getting commands through
that
her eye.
That was when started leading up to the stuff you have to know.
Yeah.
But that's episode 4, and that was the first time, because I watched the first 3 episodes, and I'm like, these are all right, and then I get to that, and I'm like, this is good. Wait, this is not a typical episode. This is set up for something later.
And there's a lot of
what it did when they introduced Hydra. They made it to where I would tell people you should watch this show, and actually don't skip those episodes because you need those.
They'll be important later.
Well, yeah, what's
important. It's
going to
be
later
irritating.
On.
There's going to be qualities of these characters that are going to piss you off.
I was fucking hating them all.
Like,
I was like,
yeah.
I was the main one leading
the
banner of like. Switch out the cast, okay? Yeah, keep Coulson
exactly.
And get rid of fucking everybody else.
No.
For the record, Cargill is pointing at Martin.
For the record, Cargill is madly in love with a certain English girl who plays a certain scientist.
Oh, you're in love with my least favorite character.
Yes, as a matter of fact, because she's amazing and
as a matter of fact, the episode I was really liking was the one where she almost died and I was just like, oh, man.
Don't you say that about my second wife. Don't you say that about my second fucking wife, dude.
They kill her off. I'll tell
her. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, Martin. We are going to. Those are fighting fucking words.
But the point of this discussion is to talk about where, at the point we are, assuming our audience has watched.
I'm sorry. I can't. I adore her, but I'm not going to fight Martin over it. Jesus Christ.
Assuming that our audience is calm.
No, I think English Kodo and Podo are great in that show. They're fucking us.
And that's because I'm a Beastmaster fan, too.
You know what? What's awesome about them is they're so easy to tell apart.
Yeah, I loved it. Like, when they brought Peter McNichol on, I was like, oh, he actually hasn't been playing this other guy the whole time.
Well, yes, we want to talk about where is Marvel Universe going now? What's going to happen in the future?
Thank you.
What's
going
to happen in the days of the future? Not necessarily past.
That's the thing. It's like, it's very obviously we have to talk about two different universes because X-Men Days of Future Past is a different universe than Marvel.
Because if they were combined, obviously they would be doing the Asgard X-Men crossover.
You know what
the
I'm
finest
really,
period of the X-Men.
You know what I'm really disappointed in? Marvel has not given a designation to the Fox Universe, cinematic universe.
Yes, because in the comics even, there's so many parallel universes. Like, the primary universe is Earth 616.
But Marvel Cinematic Universe is 199.999.
Yes. So why not, like, give a definition to that Fox Universe? Maybe even reference it offhand in the upcoming Fantastic Four movie that Marvel is trying to kill.
Aren't they trying to, like, kill that by attrition?
That's the rumor. No one really knows what they're doing.
No, there's been, like, artists have submitted, like, on the fly.
Oh no, but Stuff was saying, like, we're trying to pull back from doing Fantastic Four stories, but that doesn't necessarily say their reasoning is because they're trying to kill the movie. They might have, like, okay, we have plans for
Fantastic, you know what, the 50,000 people
giant event.
I believe, no, they do. I believe the X-Men universe is called Earth FUX.
But oddly, Marvel wasn't trying to do anything to... they're not trying to do anything to fuck the X-Men movies.
Yeah, X-Men movies are making
and partially
money.
Because they're like, well, we'd be idiots if we tried to stop making X-Men books.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they don't have a choice. Chris Claremont kind of created their biggest seller of all fucking time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that and Spider-Man are their, like, you know, cash cow.
Yeah, but Spider-Man... Second tier to the X-Men.
Still second tier to the X-Men, no question.
X-Men still sold the greatest number of comics of all time. 8 million comics. X-Men number one. Fuck you, Spider-Man.
X-Men number one.
wait, with the foil cover?
Do you,
the
you realize...
Cover?
No, they all count together. That's why it's 8 million. It's
you realize...
Wait, hold on. You do realize the whole reason it's the best-selling comic of all time is because all of us who are collecting comics at the time bought all 4 fucking covers.
So you can have the full layouts.
Yes, so you could actually put together the picture of the blue and the gold team together. So it's like, yay, I have all 4 comic covers, which also led to the death of comics in the 90s. Yeah. You know, X-Men 1 is both the beginning and the end of the greatest era of comic books of all time.
Let's talk for, like, in the wake of, in the movie universe, Days of Future Past, what do we think they're actually going to do at this point with the X-Men films?
Well, obviously.
They've got, well, no.
They're going to make good movies is what they're going to do.
I mean, more specifically in the sense that, like, we have seen, A, did Weapon X ever happen? I mean,
yes, we saw... Yes, it did.
But we don't know.
Yes, it did, because he's still got the adamantium claws. Fuck you.
In the one, the universe resets?
Yes.
Yeah. Did we
because he's still got adamantium claws.
Did we see them?
I don't remember seeing the adamantium claws, because I was looking.
But I'm assuming they do.
Cool with the adamantium claws.
Yes. We saw him.
Whoa. That's not true. Wolverine with bone claws is still fucking cool.
No, he is not.
All right, old man.
You're absolutely wrong.
It's not just me. My kids, they don't like that.
I'm actually with Cargill.
No one likes that. Oh, wait, you two actually like that?
I'm with Cargill.
What in the holy goddamn fuck is wrong with you?
First of all, if I have a choice, I go adamantium claws.
Of course you do.
Yeah, of course.
But I don't think bone claws are uncool.
Exactly.
Bone claws are uncool because they're constantly getting stepped on and broken.
They're made out of bone.
But they also
he also regenerates, motherfucker.
Yeah, but they don't cut metal.
Yes, have you ever tried to cut anything with a bone?
With a bone?
Yes, I have. It's called women, and shut the fuck up.
Is Wolverine more powerful without adamantium claws? No question.
I'm going to go.
No question.
Have you ever had a bone saw, motherfucker? Fuck you.
I'm fine with that. I'm going to go get a bucket of KFC and a stick of butter, and we're going to have a little competition.
But I'm just saying, in the context of the character, with everything we've known about him so far, having him be aware that he used to have adamantium claws and not having them anymore is a dramatic scenario to begin with.
Although, if
it ends up in a future situation where that never happens.
I would argue that if we're talking about Days of Futures Past, technically the Wolverine in that universe will not remember what happened to him because it was future Wolverine that was living that life and will not recall what happened.
No, they made clear in that movie that he's the only guy who's going to remember what happened.
No.
That was a big plot point.
Yeah,
they said
a big plot point.
He was the only person who would remember everything.
It's a wonderful Wolverine life. Gene, you're still here. And Scott.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay. We're back in Westchester, Mary.
Hold on. No. But he remembers it when he returns to his era of, you know, that time. The Wolverine back then doesn't remember what happened to
him. That's true. But the
Wolverine
story
that returns to the moment at which he was otherwise fighting evil sentinels made by Tyrion from Game of Thrones.
Will not remember. But
when he wakes up and it's Mystique in there, yes, that's a big question.
If they choose to make an X-Men movie that takes place where we saw the end of X-Men Days of Future Past, with the Wolverine who's suddenly like, I don't actually remember all the shit in that big break of stuff that happened like the last 40 years or so, but I remember all the alternative universe stuff that no longer exists, where I had adamantium claws.
I'm hoping, I mean, this is a huge rabbit hole. We're trying to ruminate about, like, what do they really mean with their time travel, and what are they going to keep? And there's no fucking way to know. What I hope they do is, obviously, they're doing Apocalypse. That's awesome. I hope they go on to that, and I hope they get past some of the more troublesome casting issues that I feel that they have had.
Storm and Femke Janssen?
Oh, my God.
Well, I've heard that's exactly what they intended.
Yes, exactly. The around-the-campfire bit is, okay, we're going to go with the more typical team, and we're going to have younger versions of this. What I really, really hope and pray they do is they go with what First Class did excellently, and that is make a movie that's not a fucking Wolverine movie.
May I share what my dream is?
Yes.
The dream that I have.
Wolverine surrounded by bones.
No, when I cuddle up at night with my pillow and I dream of an X-Men universe, cinematic universe.
It's a musical.
It's called X-Men with an exclamation point.
It's the last 2 minutes of Mad Men. Mad Men.
You might be able to get Alan Cummings to come back for that.
No, here's what I want.
Oh, my God.
I want what Sony is talking about. I want an X-Men movie every year. And what I want is Fox clearly wants a Wolverine movie every 3 years. That's fine. Everyone loves Wolverine. And you know what? As he gets older, he looks more and more like Wolverine every goddamn year.
It's true. And when he starts getting a dowager hump and actually gets short, he's going to be fucking awesome.
He's going to be awesome. So, no, but what I want is I want to see an X-Men movie every 3 years. I'll let them have a Wolverine movie every 3 years. And then I want a movie about an X-Man every 3 years and set it at different times. What I want... I want them to next do an 80s movie about a teenage Storm, and I want it to do about Storm in Africa coming, you know.
Yeah, doing her big trip.
Yeah, you know, I want the origin of Storm. Yeah. I want that to lead up to an X-Men movie in which we do the Mutant Massacre, where we get to see Storm lose her powers and end up, end up leading the Morlocks.
Storm losing her powers, Genosha, of these things.
I want
you have to have a story. You have to start developing Storm as a character who's not just like a series of a poorly executed one-liners.
But that's what I'm talking about. What I want is every 3 years, I want a different X-Men to be featured as a character. You know, the other characters they haven't done yet that you know they're going to do eventually, like Longshot. I want to see, you know what I want to fucking see? I want to see Kitty Pryde and Wolverine movie.
You think they're going to make a Longshot movie? You're adorable.
Oh, you know what? Introduce Longshot to this era. Let's see. You get the right actor for Longshot, people are going to want to fucking see Longshot.
Yeah, but Mark Hamill's too old for it.
He bought a Longshot fucking comic book. Fuck you, I lived in the 80s.
I bought a Star Yours limited series in the 80s.
Look, Martin, you know what I'm talking
about. I'm with
Bo
on this one. They're not going to make a Longshot.
Yeah.
But they might make a
gamble. But it would be awesome.
They might make
it?
A Gambit. They will make a Gambit.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there's no question.
If they can finally find an actor who could play Gambit without it being a joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem with Gambit is Gambit was a really good character in the late 80s, early 90s was when it when Retribution and Rebirth happened. Storm was reborn as a 10-year-old girl and ran into Gambit. But Gambit was cool then, but a lot of the things that make him Gambit that everyone's like, I love that dude, is like, yeah, that shit doesn't really work in 2014.
Yeah, now he's the Cajun Chef.
It's like, I guarantee I'll be the greatest X-Men of all time.
Yeah, the Louisiana Bayou Cajun accent has been bastardized to all hell, and now it's just like, oh, now... this is just some guy from the fucking Boondocks who's going to rape me.
Well, it was always like, oh, he's that cool character who wears a trench coat over his costume, which is all shiny purple and blue with a Olivia Newton-John headband.
Hey now. He's got some cooler costumes. Like when he dressed up like a stormtrooper, that was fucking awesome.
what I would really love to see is I would like them to follow the Marvel Universe's lead and start going off into space. I would love to see the Brood. That is probably agreed. My number one storyline.
That's a hard story to tell.
Not if Guardians of the Galaxy ends up sucking, yes, it is a hard sell. After that, I disagree.
You know who needs to write it? J. Michael Straczynski. Because of Babylon 5 and the run of the Shadows on Babylon 5, who were basically Brood, the Brood if they had stealth technology.
I thought the Xenomorphs from Aliens were basically the Brood.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that are basically the Brood.
But the Brood are intelligent.
Yeah, but the
John
Brood.
Byrne, Chris Claremont, went and saw Alien and went, holy shit, we got to do a comic based on this.
No, you're right, but like later on Babylon 5, those characters, the Shadows, were the ones that were much more like what the Brood actually were like. This highly organized, hive mind, really evil, super intelligent.
No, they weren't even a hive mind. They were all individuals. I mean, they had a queen who was their leader, but there was independent thought. And,
and plus, Straczynski has been a Marvel writer.
Out of curiosity, I know Martin has played it. Have either of you guys played Marvel Heroes?
Have not.
No.
Oh, they actually there
I,
is.
I know a lot of people who've done the voice work for it, but
I last time we talked about this, I really wanted to like it and was having issues with it. I have since fallen in love with it, and it's what I do in all my spare time that I'm not writing or watching stuff or hanging out with my wife.
What's your character name on it? So if people want to find you,
well, it's pretty easy to find.
Is it?
It's Mass Worm. Oh, yeah, everything I ever do is Mass Worm. If I'm ever anywhere, I'm Mass Worm.
Which character did you go with?
Well, I've played many of them. That's okay. The thing is I've actually gotten a dozen characters up to 60.
Oh, wow.
And, no, I'm madly in love with the game.
When you say spare time.
Well, no. First of all, the thing with Marvel Heroes is that you actually, the more heroes you get to 60, the more experience you gain. It's actually, the thing about Marvel Heroes, unlike any other MMORPG, because it's actually an ARPG, an action role-playing game, the more heroes you get to 60, the more of an experience boost you get, so the faster it gets. So as you get more and more characters, the faster it is to get them to 60. And once you learn what the end game is, there are people who get their characters to 60 in 4 to 5 hours.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, they have gotten so many characters built up, and they drop a bunch of experience boosts, and they know exactly how to do it to where they're like, I'm level 60, and they have races on the day new characters come out to get the new character to level 60.
All right, but I'm going to say it now.
But
stay on topic.
I am.
On topic.
The topic is, even they have a popular character that they sell every once in a while. It's a special character, which is Brood Wolverine, which is the cover of that Brood issue in which it's Wolverine as a brood. And
I have like long box after long box filled with comics all in practically
that issue mint condition. Is amazing.
And I know they're worth a lot of money, but I just am too scared to actually go and price them all. Because I'm afraid I might spend like 6 weeks on eBay
selling them,
trying to sell them. I'm like, I never open them or read them anymore, and I don't have that sort of.
Well, you're not a real nerd. I'm just what proud kind of real of nerd doesn't read the old fucking Chris Claremont X-Men?
Oh, I do. I have the trades.
No. Loser. Oh, look at the hipster comic lover. Oh, he reads the trades. Oh,
now I think the hipster in this factor is somebody quite different. It's the guy standing over there with the Victrola and the wax cylinders.
I would argue that the loser in this scenario is quite different as well.
All right, but talking about what we want to see with what's going to come up with these X-Men films, I mean, do you think there's even a chance that we're going to see Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen returning again as those roles and doing a present day? Or are they just going to primarily focus on James McAvoy and
Michael Fassbender? I don't know. He keeps getting bigger and bigger. They might not always be able to pull him in.
Why are you talking shit about a guy? He's on a diet.
No. I honestly, I think they're probably going to try to figure out how to do both.
Yeah,
I think that's what they're going to do. It's really one of those things that
they've already figured out the way. Yeah. they literally just did. Yeah.
Those guys love the characters. They love the roles. They love that they're indefinite. They love working with the people they're working with.
Yeah,
and it's one of those things. And for fuck's sake, all four of those motherfuckers have played Hamlet. Like, this is, like, they're like, God. I can go on Hamlet, I can go on stage at any time and play Hamlet, or I could do all this stuff that makes me artistically satisfied, or I could go and do an X-Men movie, at which point they'll give me a huge check, and all of these teenage kids will then go out and want to see me as Hamlet.
You know, if that's the thing, they should just add Mel Gibson to the cast.
Mel Gibson,
he'd
by
make
the way,
an excellent apocalypse.
Hold on, fuck you. No. In the 1990s, Mel Gibson would have made an amazing Wolverine.
We have to kill all these Jews. Mutants!
Newtons!
Damn it!
Mutants! Yeah, he'd make a great striker
He never wanted to kill the Jews. He loves a Jew.
All right, so what's in the terms of the X-Men, all the characters we haven't seen yet that are coming, or ones that desperately need to be recast and probably will be, what actors do you guys see as like dream coming into it to play?
At this point, I've got a huge fetish for casting Lupita Nyong'o as Storm.
I'm right there with you.
Fucking
yes.
Yeah, I think during the Oscar podcast, I even said, I'm sorry, does anybody else think that she's the correct person to take over Storm?
Yeah, no, it's like, oh, hey, somebody who can keep an African accent?
Yeah.
I want to see somebody at some point do Colossus. And a Colossus who actually like talks and interacts with everybody.
Who's not like a background.
And not only that, not only do we need to see a good actor playing Colossus, we need to see a great young actress playing Ilyana.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The Ileana Rasputin as Magic. Because the Magic story, you know, starting her as the little girl and then having her abducted. Gee, I wonder where some of the inspiration for my first book may have come from about a young girl being abducted and then showing up, you know.
I bought that first Blasco issue on
Fucking X-Men. Yeah, was it 151?
Yeah.
That Blasco abducts Ileana Rasputin and takes her into limbo. Honestly, and then she shows back up as a 16-year-old girl.
And I realize not everybody's the same way, but the last truly great Claremont run was that whole like
fuck you
Magic takes.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that. I wouldn't go that.
I mean, that was for me where I kind of like this was great, and then after that, I was like, you know what? No. I'm kind of losing it.
No, Retribution and Rebirth was fucking.
No, I realize that like there's like well worth it, but
Retribution and Rebirth is 128 through or 228 through 270.
I think a lot of it was just like I was ready to stop addictively reading comic books for a while.
I will
of
say
pussy and weed.
I will say, casting wise, hey man, as long as he's at there, get Hathor Hjarlsr Furthern's son, or whoever the hell is the guy who's playing the new Mountain in Game of Thrones. Juggernaut, just saying.
Yeah. Oh, a Juggernaut that doesn't reference an internet meme? That would be nice.
Exactly, yes.
Because since that movie never existed.
Did you see that thing today? It was around the net where he was lifting almost 1,000
pounds. 994 pounds.
The man could pick up a washing machine and toss it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean lick its butt. I mean fucking hurl it.
Toss it? Really? We had to go there? Jesus.
Yes.
Jesus. Yeah, no, you know the character I really want to see that we haven't seen yet? And I'm there's part of me that's like, dude, you're fucking 38 years old. Don't go there. And then there's a part of me that's like, I'm still a 14-year-old inside. Fuck you.
Lockheed?
I want to see Dazzler. I want to see a 70s era Dazzler, for fuck's sake.
I think one of them, I can't believe they have not brought him in yet, but Forge is definitely someone I would love to see.
Forge is fucking awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
Him and developing him with Storm would
Forge,
be amazing.
Forge, the character, his mutant power is to be like, well, what's the
absolute
definite
amazing?
He's like,
mechanical
mutant power is like he can figure out anything technically. And
well, not only that, he can actually build anything technically. That's the thing, is he could literally be, hey, you need a time machine? I'm like MacGyver, but like I make MacGyver look like a fucking simpleton.
Isn't his mutant name Deus Ex Machina?
it's something like that.
The builders from the Lego movie.
He was one of the new X-Men from 264. One of my favorite single issues where it's like, hey, look, we've got the new X-Men. Oh, we're just kidding. They look like the new X-Men on the cover. We're killing half of them in the issue.
I'm actually curious to know who you would have play for.
No, what makes Forge more special than anything? He's like the one Native American comic book character who doesn't wear fringe.
Yeah, true shit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, who is that great actor from the 90s who was in Smoke Signals who played
Adam
the older
Beach.
Guy?
Yeah, Adam Beach.
Adam Beach.
Oh yeah,
to play
I could definitely see him as a more mature Forge.
Had to be watching the Lone Ranger going, oh, son of a bitch.
Oh, god damn it. Really, Johnny Depp? Fuck you.
I would really like to see them, you know, franchise out further and do the obvious. It's like, yeah, you don't have access to the Marvel Universe, but god, you practically do. You've got the New Mutants. You've got X-Force. You've got, you know, the Star Jammers, for Christ's sakes. You could just go on and on. And I really hope that all of these guys are brought in. I would love to see something based on the first New Mutants trade paperback.
Can I just say that I want somebody, anybody, fucking Marvel, fucking Fox, I don't give a shit, Disney or Fox, somebody do something with Carol fucking Danvers, for Christ's sake. I mean, god damn it, either give us Miss Marvel or give us Binary. Don't keep fucking dickering with each other over who has the rights to her. Somebody fucking do her, because all of her story is awesome.
I volunteer to do her.
Miss Marvel is one of the coolest fucking characters in the Marvel universe.
Absolutely.
Binary, holy shit, the whole story, the whole arc of Binary, right down to her saving the planet by fucking absorbing all, you know, absorbing what's happening to our sun and expending her cosmic powers to save Earth only for nobody to fucking recognize how awesome she is.
What's interesting
about her is awesome.
Like a lot of other Marvel female characters are interesting because partially I suspect the company didn't know what to do with them.
Well, they didn't. I mean, that's what's so great.
I think they finally figured out Carol.
Well, except yeah. well, the
they
thing,
did. Yes,
the
they
thing
did.
Is in the '70s, they had no idea what to do with Carol Danvers. And they had that whole great, you know, they had that whole arc where she's taken to an alternate dimension and through science, she is reconditioned to become the queen to this king of this alternate reality. And then this woman wrote this great essay called The Rape of Carol Danvers, The Rape of Miss Marvel. And Chris Claremont totally agreed with her. And so Chris Claremont set out to retcon the entire universe of what they'd done to this great character of Carol Danvers. And he created Rogue as a result of that. Yeah. Rogue was created to steal her memories, and then he turned her into binary. And Chris Claremont told some of the greatest Carol Danvers stories ever.
And, honestly,
and that's why we're stuck in this fucked up thing where Marvel and Fox don't know exactly how much of Carol Danvers they own, so nobody does anything with it.
And the whole thing with Rogue was she was a great character because Carol Danvers was a really interesting character.
Because Carol Danvers was in her head.
The pathos that was involved there with her, this was my ability was to steal people's abilities, and this is the time it fucked up and went totally wrong and wouldn't go away.
For those of you that don't know, in Avengers Annual number 10, which is Rogue's first appearance,
she's good with the number
10. I will bet all the money in my bank account against all yours that it's Avengers Annual number 10.
Let's put those nerd dicks back in our nerd pants.
No. It is Avengers Annual number 10, motherfucker. Do not fuck with me on Rogue.
Please tuck it back into your smelly, smelly drawstring. So,
the way these guys are looking at each other right now, let me just say this.
Who runs Botatown? Who runs Botatown?
Master Blaster run Botatown, motherfucker.
Or Massa Worm.
So it's Massa Worm run Botatown. So Rogue shows up and tries to steal Carol Danvers' powers, but she doesn't fully understand her power, and she holds on to Carol Danvers too much and takes, not only does she keep Miss Marvel's powers, but her psyche lives in the back of her head.
Right.
And until, I think it's issue 270 that they're in the Savage Land and her and Magneto finally deal with the whole thing and she fights the weird alternate version of Miss Marvel and she finally wins over her own psyche. For almost 100 issues of X-Men, Rogue is wrestling with Carol Danvers in her head. And it's one of the greatest storylines in the Marvel Universe.
Well, especially when Binary just like, after being gone for a long time, decides to show up at the Xavier Mansion.
Yeah. That's one of the best scenes in the entire
X-verse. The fuck is this bitch doing
here? Yeah.
When Carol sees her again for the first time after getting her Binary powers and like literally like carries her about 50 fucking blocks away with a punch.
And then they do it again in the Miss Marvel reboot in which a Rogue from an alternate universe shows up to kill Carol Danvers in our universe. And we find out that this Rogue has been going from universe to universe, killing Carol Danverses and winning every time. It's one of the greatest arcs in the history of Marvel Comics, but because
it's so fucking convoluted, we will probably never ever get.
Well,
it
no,
on,
it's
on
not
Sullivan.
Only it's not only convoluted as a story; it's convoluted in the rights because half of it occurs in X-Men and half of it occurs in Marvel.
As you said earlier, they have no idea who actually owns
the
rights.
They just got to Quicksilver that shit.
You say that, where it's like, hey, by the way, we're not going to mention what, you know, we're not going to say the name Quicksilver. We're going to mention my normal name, but we're going to mention that, hey, my mom used to know a guy like you because we're not actually allowed to mention that you're my dad. But at the same time, neither is fucking Marvel. So they can't even use the word mutants.
Right.
So let me
say this. The internet has put out a lot of speculation that if they were going to do Ms. Marvel, which certainly certain people from Marvel have insinuated strongly that they would like to, that Katie Sackhoff is the leading person that they would look at. And I tend to agree. That's like,
I think for the older, wiser,
for Ms. Marvel,
for the older, wiser Captain Marvel. No, not the one you're shaking your head at that Chris Claremont wrote a lot of.
No.
But the Ms. Marvel that we've gotten in the Avengers and the Captain Marvel what we have now, yes, I think Katie Sackhoff is perfect.
Okay, well, I was not disagreeing with that. I was disagreeing with your choice of actress.
No, by all means, tell us what who you think. That's why I brought
then,
it up.
Then you were disagreeing with what I said.
I was in fact disagreeing with what you said.
That's pretty much the...
Oh my God, now I've suffered from Cargillism. I've forgotten her name from Monster.
Charlize Theron.
Charlize Theron would play an awesome older, wiser Miss Marvel.
I would agree with both of those choices.
Yeah. No, Katie Sackhoff would also be great. She'd be the great younger version of that. But I think Charlize Theron, when I think Miss Marvel, Charlize Theron is Miss Marvel.
Right, I got no problem with that.
We're getting to the point where we have to wrap this up. But I have one last question. We talked about this recently because we're big Mad Men fans. And we're like, John Hamm needs to play a superhero or supervillain at some point because he's just got that quality. And whereas the obvious choice is, of course, that older statesman Superman, which is DC Universe.
Kal-El with just one L.
Yeah. But like, let's say that's out of the question. Let's say DC in its entirety is out of the question for John Hamm to play. That Marvel goes, we know we want you to play something.
You know, the only, because we talked about this, and the only thing that came to mind was a character they've already cast, and I thought they miscast to begin with, though they miscast it in a good movie. And that was X-Men First Class, because I do love X-Men First Class. But I think fucking John Hamm is Sebastian Shaw.
Yeah.
That
would have been a great choice.
He would have been, but then they would have been, oh, really? White Queen and Black King are played by two characters from Mad Men? Yeah, yeah, let's go with Kevin Bacon.
That would have been perfect, though. Although I will say, like, coming off that, I returned with, you know what? They're going into the apocalypse story. If you were going to reinvent it, Mr. Sinister.
No, he would be a good Mr. Sinister.
Like, to recanonize it for the film universe where he's like, until it gets to that point where it's a crisis point in the story, where he's being assaulted from all sides, and then he reverts to whatever his actual alien form or what happened.
And what I'm blank.
He's John Hamm playing basically Don Draper.
You handed me rum, so now my brain power is diminishing at an exponential rate. But who was the guy who led the Reavers that wasn't Mr. Sinister? Who was the head of the Reavers? Because the Reavers were initially with the Hellfire Club, but there was a lead guy in the Reavers.
I don't remember
that, whose image I can see in my head, but I can't remember his name.
I'm sure someone will say in the comments.
Yeah, someone will say in the comments. That's who it is.
Acolyte?
No. It wasn't Acolyte. I can't remember because it was an actual guy's name, and I'm blanking on who it was. Because he was the guy, because Mr. Sinister wasn't involved, but during Retribution and Rebirth, which is what I argue is the greatest Chris Claremont run ever. You know, when he started, when he had the greatest X-Men team ever in the Outback, because Outback X-Men is the best X-Men team ever, hands fucking down.
Speaks volumes as to why his new book takes place in Australia.
Yeah. Oh God, I actually wrote it. I wrote an article about that, about how Chris Claremont's Outback Australia, and about a story written by, and I'm blanking on her name, a story that was in Marvel Spotlight, and I'm blanking on the name of who wrote it. But how there's a great story in which I just was talking Longshot. Longshot learns to dreamwalk. It's X-Men. It wasn't Spotlight. What was that great comic they had back in the day that was four short 8-page comics a piece in each issue? So you got four stories.
It's like Marvel Treasury or yeah,
it wasn't Treasury, but yeah, it was something. Titles, it was in issue 16, and Longshot learns how to dreamwalk, and that was the first time I'd heard about it, and it forced me to look it up and go, holy shit, this dreamwalking thing, this is a real thing, and the Outback mythology, and that's how I discovered Outback mythology. Right. Yeah. But Chris Claremont is how I discovered all this amazing stuff in the Outback that inspired my second book,
Or at least not discovered, but inspired.
Inspired. Well, but he inspired the discovery of it because I went and started reading all this stuff and like, holy shit, there's this deep mythology going back 25,000 fucking years that we in the West just kind of pretend doesn't exist.
As you said to me, like all these mythologies have evolved so much throughout the West and the East and what have you. But the mythology of Australia and the Outback has remained relatively unchanged for thousands and thousands.
For tens of thousands of years. But anyhow, but Retribution and Rebirth was what I would argue is the greatest arc.
So John Hamm would play
So John Hamm would play the leader of the Reavers in that point, whose character name is blanking on me, and I can't.
I gotta say, if John Hamm's playing anybody in the Marvelverse, and unfortunately we've decided to go in a completely different direction with this franchise, but dude, Ray fucking Richards, come on. I mean, the guy's got that elder statesman gravitas.
He's too pretty and he's too cool for Reed Richards. Yeah. Reed Richards has to be a bit nerdier.
That's because you're thinking of him as Don Draper.
No. But I mean, I kind of agree with them, actually. It's, if you were going to do a Fantastic Four has been around for a long time movie, like they've been established, they've been around for 30 years.
That's what I'm talking about.
Then yes.
That's what I'm talking about.
I can see.
And I think that's really like, If something went horribly wrong and Marvel, or horribly right, depending on how you want to look at it, and Marvel got the rights back to Fantastic Four, that's how I would like to see them come into play, as these guys have been around for a while.
I think he works best as a villain. I think as an actor, he's much better as being a charismatic bad guy than he is being a likable good guy.
My second tier thing, it was just an odd thing, but just because I can picture him with glowing eyes, I think he'd make a really interesting and cool Molten Man, but we're never going to get the Molten Man.
I will say for the record, another actor who really wants to be part of the Marvel Universe and probably will get his point in eventually is Channing Tatum, who has been trying to get roles that he will never, ever get. But I think when we were talking about it, I said Doc Samson.
Oh, yeah, no.
From the Hulk. I was like, I totally see him as
Doc Samson.
He'd
be cool, but, you know, Modern Family is already playing that guy. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Huh?
Modern Family is already playing that guy.
Modern Family?
Yeah, Ty Burrell has already played Doc Samson in the franchise.
Yes, but we know that.
I know. But it was funny because he's in Modern Family.
Yeah. Yeah. Eric Stone Street is the thing. I'm just saying. Yeah.
Might as well.
You know what? I'll throw this out there. You know who he needs to play? He needs to play the original Captain Marvel before the mantle is handed over to Carol Danvers,
actually,
who then becomes Miss Marvel.
Actually, that's not bad.
Okay, he would be a great Captain. You'd watch him in the first act of the movie, and you'd be like, holy shit, this guy's a fucking superhero. He comes to the end of his run. He's about to die. He hands over the mantle to Miss Marvel. Bam, we're off to the races.
To a Guardians of the Galaxy sequel, where he becomes a major character in that. And then a Ms. Marvel film, where he is the link point.
Red and blue suit or green and white?
You're thinking too
heavy. Dude, Captain Marvel.
Has Marvel ever adapted somebody's suit right on?
You know what?
Marvel never takes anybody's suit right on. They fuck with everyone's suit, and yet at the same time, they're also kind of awesome. That's one of the neat things about Marvel Heroes that we were talking about earlier, in which every time a new movie comes out, they put out the cinematic version of the suit that you can play the character as. And I've got Captain America, and I haven't played him yet, but I'm like, I gotta buy the Captain America suit, because it's so cool with the star in the chest, it's so awesome.
Speaking of suits, I'm gonna lay down a full house and say that I've just closed this round of play for the original Gentleman. You guys can pay me later. But it has gotten to be for our time.
Yeah.
1 something in the morning.
I would love to ramble on for a couple hours.
Cardio, will you
more,
come and join us again sometime soon?
Oh, wait, you guys know that if you ever give me a call and ask me to come over, I'll be fucking
okay, because this is one of the more fun episodes we've done
a
while.
Yeah, easily.
We're all on the same page, and it's so much fun to go like deep, deep geek shit into this stuff. So
it's Avengers Annual number 10, Martin, and I'm gonna fucking prove it when we turn off the mics, and you're gonna be embarrassed.
But thank you for joining us. We'll be back in another 2 weeks with I don't know what yet.
We'll be talking about the Avengers number 9.
Avengers Giant Size number 9.
Oh, Giant Size Man thing.